Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
They shootin'.
A shooter opening fire on a group of people. The FBI calls that an active shooter incident, and today the agency says such cases are on the rise. The FBI's new study shows that between 2000 and 2013, there were 160 active shooter incidents. NPR's Brian Naylor joins us now with more details. And Brian, tell us more about how this phrase is defined specifically by the FBI.
Right. The federal law enforcement officials say that an active shooting is one where someone is actively engaged in killing or trying to kill people in a confined or populated area. So it could be a factory or a shopping mall or a school. And for this study, they didn't look at gang or drug-related shootings, but the kinds of shootings that all too frequently occur. Think of the Navy Yard shooting here in Washington a year ago, or shootings at the Aurora movie theater in Colorado, or Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. The FBI says in the first 7 years of its study, it found an average of 6.4 of these shootings a year. But in the last 7 years, there's been a big jump, up to 16.4 shootings a year, or a little more than one a month. And in these shootings, not including the shooters, 486 people were killed and 557 people were wounded.
Why did the FBI conduct this study in the first place? What are they hoping to do with this data?
Well, the FBI says they want to establish a baseline, that they've never had all of this information in one place, and they want to know how to best respond to these shootings, and of course they want to figure out how to prevent them. So, for instance, they found that in they were able to measure most ended in minutes, 5 minutes or less, many in 2 minutes or less. Mm. That's obviously before police are able to respond. And so one thing the FBI hopes is to impress upon people or companies, schools, that they need to be prepared for such incidents. Here's Catherine Schweit, who is with the FBI's Active Shooter Initiative.
21 of the 160 incidents, so that's 13.1%, unarmed citizens selflessly stepped in the way to prevent the shooter and the shooting from continuing. And I think it's an amazing thing to think about, and how our people are taking responsibility, and they need to be prepared for that.
And these are dangerous situations for law enforcement when they do arrive at the scene. In about half of the cases, they were wounded by the shooter, and 9 officers were killed.
Brian, what does this report tell us about the shooters themselves and where these incidents occur?
That they're most often, but not always, males, that they're most often acting alone. About 40% commit suicide. Most are using handguns, but sometimes they do use rifles. And the FBI didn't determine whether the weapons were obtained legally or illegally. But an FBI behavioral analyst who spoke today said the shooters tend to have real or perceived grievances, and that the shooters, they think the only way they're able to find relief for these grievances is through violence. And some of these are also copycat incidents, where a shooter has been found to have researched previous shootings before acting.
So now the FBI has compiled this information. What happens to it now?
Well, they're hoping to figure out ways to prevent these shootings, using behavioral science to identify people who might be on the edge of a violent act, what are the warning signs, and training, again, whether it's businesses or schools, to recognize these signs, and also to train law enforcement on how best to respond to them, to make sure police have additional body armor or medical kits or rifles in their cars to deal with these incidents.
Okay, Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
NPR's Brian Naylor. We were talking about a new FBI study. It shows the number of so-called active shooter incidents in the U.S. has more than doubled in recent years.
Context of white supremacy. Justice Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, September 25th, 2014, so I have been told. We should be back tomorrow, third installment, Mr. Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It. Fantastic book. I don't think I can only think of really one other time where I was reading a book and I knew before I was even halfway through the book that this is going to be like one of my top 10 favorite books of all time. I think Mr. Williams' bang has accomplished that. It is fantastic. Looking forward. We're picking up on chapter 10 for tomorrow. We should be here on Saturday with the compensatory call-in. We should be here Sunday. Dr. Missy Harris, that was the report, I think, from about 2 weeks ago now, the black female dentist, where her white colleagues had been spying on her social networking activities, and they were upset with her because she had been posting about Ferguson and racism, and they said that they wanted that activity to cease and desist, and she ended up resigning her position. She should be on the program on Sunday. And then Monday, we should have a black male joining us from Sweden. Obviously, with the time difference, we'll be on much earlier than our normal broadcast schedule, but they are doing some interesting things. They just had a big post in the New York Times about their right-wing resurgence, the terms that they use in Sweden, but that should be Monday, very early on Monday, so staying active. Also, briefly, I know there were some issues. There was a site-wide problem with the last two programs. Debbie Irving, admitted racist, and Crystal Tyler from Monday and Tuesday of this week. There were site-wide issues that resulted in the archives not being immediately available, but they are available now. They should be on iTunes and wherever else you normally access the content. I know I had said last time, if you have issues with that, just drop me an email or let me know. I've got far more emails where people are responding to what they heard as opposed to people saying that they were having trouble. So I assume most folks are good, but if you have any issues, it should be straightened out now. Feel free to let me know if you have problems. With that, very interesting context around our broadcast today, what we're talking about, just some of the more recent things that have been happening over the last 48 hours. Number one, the resignation of Attorney General Eric Holder. That was surprising, but then I did have to remember he had been saying, if you recall back in 2012, that he was going to step down at the end of President Obama's first term, and then he stayed on, but just getting that he was resigning with it being right in the middle of midterms coming up and everything, I just thought that was very interesting, and it was one of those that made me think, wow, I wonder what type of pressure he has been under, being a non-white male in that position and everything that's been going on directly around racism. But that's definitely something to kind of keep in mind during this dialogue, as well as the decision yesterday in Ohio that Jonathan Crawford III, the black male who was shot and killed in Walmart for holding a BB gun, that there will be no indictments of the white officers who shot and killed him. They said this at the same time that they released the video footage in color, so you can see him being shot down, and you can clearly see that he was not aiming this BB gun at anyone. He was not threatening anyone. He was not making demands. He was not jumping up and down. He was not being unruly in any way, shape, or form. And the enforcement officials came in and shot him pretty quickly. It did not look like they gave him time to respond, react, anything. It just looked like they went in guns a-blazing, killing a black male right in cold blood, and then no indictments, no crime here. And the final, I guess, and also Marlene Pinnock, they settled. That was a black female that was brutally beaten by a California Highway Patrolman, white officer, that they settled. I think it was $1.5 million. I'm still looking for an indictment, some sort of conviction for his conduct. I haven't seen anything about that, but she did have made a settlement, $1.5 million, the figure that I saw. And finally, the seriousness of our discussion for today. Just keep in mind, this week, big chatter about the new show, Black-ish. If you can kind of hold two concepts at one time, think about what we're talking about today and the seriousness of that, particularly with regards to all of the shooting incidents and what have you that have happened over the past 45 days. Hold that, and then this is the big show that they're talking about. This is progress, and things are working out great for black people, Blackish. I don't know if folks got to see it, but the pilot episode is online if you are interested. Our guest for today's program, real pleasure to have him on the broadcast. If you were listening the last time that Dr. Tommy Curry visited with us, we were talking about all these issues and how serious white supremacy is at this point, particularly with the number of police incidents where they are shooting, killing, beating, raping black people. And he mentioned the work of one of his students. He said that he just finished up an outstanding dissertation documenting young white people who are organizing. It's under the banner of Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. So these are younger white people, not the Clive and Bundy, not Charlton Heston, young millennials saying that we feel threatened and we feel a need to have a firearm to defend ourselves. And I thought it would be fantastic. His dissertation is not even published yet, so we're kind of getting something a little bit ahead of the curve. It'll give somebody something to look forward to when the final report is released. It is titled Prepared, Not Paranoid, An Examination of Race and Gender Within Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. Fascinating report, and I think even the audio that we started the broadcast with, which was just yesterday, saying that there is a rise in the number of what they're calling active shooters. If you note, they did not mention race at all. I think if they were truthful, they would probably have to say that most of these quote-unquote active shooting incidents are white males. But our guest, maybe he can touch on that as well. His areas of interest include criminology, racial and ethnic studies, critical race theory, identity, and social movements. Two of the folks that were on his graduate committee, Dr. Joe Fagan and Dr. Tommy Curry, they have both been guests on the program. You can go back in the archives to hear what they had to say. Finished up his PhD and graduate work at Texas A&M. Real pleasure to have him on the program with us. Joining us live, Dr. Todd C. Couch. Dr. Couch, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you very much for having me. Very happy to be able to speak with you tonight.
Pleasure is ours, Dr. Couch. For our listening audience, this might be their first time hearing about you and the work that you do. Anything you think it would be helpful for listeners to know about you before we get started?
You summed it up pretty well. My areas that I do much of the heavy lifting in tend to be in criminology, and then racial and ethnic studies. Also have a very big emphasis on critical race theory, black radical social philosophy. So those are the different things that really influence much of my frames that I interpreted my work through, as well as many of the incidents that I observed kind of leading into the project that we'll be discussing tonight.
Outstanding. You are a black male, is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I am.
Right on. This program, context of white supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of white supremacy racism. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yes, I believe you're spot on. I believe you're spot on with your definition, and that many times whenever we are discussing, at least what I handle in my courses and in my work, I'm sure you may have noticed, is whenever we're discussing white supremacy, very much like you said, it's a global system. That's what we're talking about, and that we have a group of Europeans who created the category of whiteness as an umbrella to mobilize under, in a means to ultimately exploit and in instances even exterminate people that do not fit into that umbrella category.
Absolutely, absolutely. I guess before we even get into your work, I feel like such I think, just extremely important turn of events with Eric Holder's resignation today. Do you have any thoughts on that? And is that in any way relevant to what we're going to be discussing with your dissertation?
I'm not sure if it necessarily relates to my dissertation, but I do think it's worth noting that he's stepping down. I heard the news early this afternoon. I was teaching the course and got out of it and saw that I got an email about it. And I wasn't surprised, because if we look at the stance that we found Eric Holder taking, it was often a little bit more militant in some ways than we got from President Obama. We find that in instances where race was really the central issue, say, for example, with the Ferguson situation, Eric Holder was the one who was given all of those responsibilities. And the backlash that he received from speaking to those instances, I believe, grappling with that, we can understand a little bit why it is that he is stepping down. And I'm sure there's much more to it, probably in a very similar direction, that will come out in the next couple of weeks as more is released about his resignation.
Mm, absolutely. Even with guns, I remember at least one of the things that he has taken a lot of criticism from many white people, and even kind of tangentially related, what they call Fast and Furious. I remember, I think it was the third debate, Mitt Romney, they were talking about gun rights and gun control, and Mitt Romney went to Fast and Furious saying, oh my gosh, he's let all these guns out and resulted in an officer being killed, and this is totally reckless and irresponsible. That's, I think he was even held in contempt, if my memory serves, for not providing documentation that they wanted around what they call Fast and Furious. I guess with that, to kind of pivot to your work. Fascinating study. Again, it is not released. I'll give the title and then kind of allow you to give an overview so our listeners can understand what this is. So the title again, Prepared, Not Paranoid, An Examination of Race and Gender Within Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. If you can kind of lay out what this project is all about.
Sure, sure. I think it'd be beneficial to kind of discuss how I even came to this project, because this actually was not the work I was planning to do for my dissertation. But after the Sandy Hook situation, I began to take more interest in these mass shooting incidents. And the thing that I noticed is, as the clip you played at the beginning kind of stated, these are almost always perpetrated by males. Out of the 62 that we've had since the FBI began collecting data, 61 have been perpetrated by men. And in all of the official documents, they'll discuss gender theoretically, but the racial thing is always left out of it. Where for me, the racial thing is what always stood out to me, is that we generally do not see people of color committing these types of crimes. We just don't. They are overwhelmingly committed by white heterosexual males. And the question that kind of stuck out to me that made me take this path a bit was, what is going on with this one specific group that is causing these types of social events? Because, again, as the clip you played at the beginning stated, they skyrocketed in the amount that we've seen in the last 7 years since President Obama was elected. And I think that's a very important point to make whenever we're discussing the changes. So we've always had small incidents of similar violent episodes, but not in the frequency and not in the level of carnage that we tend to observe today. And so I was very interested in understanding what exactly is going on with white, middle-class, largely heterosexual males that's making them lash out at society in such a way that nobody else does. And as I began to look into this a bit more, inevitably I came across gun rights organizations, as one would expect. But largely in any gun rights organization, groups like the NRA, for example, they tend to be comprised of older whites. But Students for Concealed Carry really caught my attention because it's comprised of millennials, people really 23-ish and below. But if we listen to the dominant cultural narratives, that group is supposed to be post-racial. That group is not supposed to believe in racial difference. Where if we look at the demographics of the group, as I began the very early stages of my project, much like many other gun rights groups, it's almost exclusively male, almost exclusively white. And historically, whenever we have groups of almost exclusively white males coming together for issues related to firearms, it almost never ends well for blacks. It almost always ends very poorly. And so that's the thing that drew me to this topic, that drew me to this organization, was what about the narratives of this group is causing its demographics to be as they are? Because it's not just, it's not a small group. They have chapters in all 50 states, so they have a decent voice. So what's going on socially, culturally, that's causing this group to attract almost exclusively white middle-class males? That's what really pushed me into the study, trying to understand. I had an hypothesis of what it was, just given my training. But I wanted to actually hear it from these millennials because, again, they're supposed to be post-racial. They're supposed to be the new vanguard of racial equality if we listen to dominant cultural narratives. But whenever we talk with them a bit more, we find that that's simply not the case. It's very much that they adhere to many of the same white supremacist narratives, often presented through colorblind rhetoric, that older generations adhere to.
Fascinating. Wow. Two quick points that I'll get in. Number one, when I was talking about this program, kind of letting people know what we would be discussing, I kept emphasizing that when Dr. Curry, I don't recall if he said that these were students. I think he just said it in a general way that, you know, he just did this work showing that these white people are getting guns and saying that there's a threat that they might have to kill some black people, non-white people. And when I dug in and was able to read your abstract and everything, and I was like, whoa, these are young white people. And I kept saying that I was stunned. I was so surprised. And when listening to called in yesterday, he said, given what you present consistently on your program about racist man, racist woman, racist child, that young white people, they are racist. It really boils down to what does it mean to be a white person, and that even white people at a very young age, they understand and demonstrate their understanding and dedication to practicing racism, including black, non-white people. And I said, it's not that I didn't think that these young millennial whites were racist, even with their President Obama buttons and whatever else that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's that whenever we start talking about gun rights and NRA types and white people getting guns, it's always presented as Clive and Bundy, Charlton Heston, old white guys, gray, in their Egypt, the people that people say, because Andre 3000 with Outkast, he just did an interview yesterday about the Jimi Hendrix film, and he said, I think racism is going to die. It's just old white people, and they're, you know, one foot in the grave. This problem is almost taken care of. We just got to wait a little while until these folks die out. All due respect, I'm not that it's totally wrong, that these young white people, they have the exact same views, the exact same behaviors. It's just refined a little bit, as you said, with the language. So you might get confused and think that that's not the case, but you would be in for a very rude awakening. And that's why I thought this was so important, your work just critical for correctly understanding what it means to be white, racism. Just to like push back, because you were saying that the increase in these types of events, starting with James Cook, we even had one of those incidents here, the Aurora theater shooting. What is your response to people who say, well, you know, you can't just try and say that these white males are lashing out, particularly over the last 6 years or so, because black people do this sort of thing all the time. This is, you know, Chicago every weekend or an area where you find a high concentration of black people. What would your response be to that?
Sure. Two things. I'd like to first talk about the Andre 3000 statement, that kind of the idea that as the older generations die out, that racial equality will automatically kind of start up. But I think the thing that we have to know is that Andre is really speaking very much so out of this dominant cultural belief that racism is inherently an individualistic trait, that it's very much individualistic, that it is very ideological, that it has no structural components. But for us as scholars who spend much of time investigating such issues, we understand that racism is fundamentally a structural issue. And I was actually talking with some students last night about this, and that if we really trace back the language of racism, it goes back to a fellow named Magnus Hirschfeld, who wrote a text that was actually entitled Racism. And he lays out what exactly racism is and how it operates. And from the very kind of development of this concept, racism was always very much a structural phenomenon. It was a power relationship. It wasn't a matter of having bad ideologies. It was very much a power struggle, very much a power relationship. And we don't really start to see this shift to race is a ideological component, race is an individualistic component, until we get into the 1980s. And under the Reagan administration, they pushed that idea very much so that race is an individual trait. And so I think with Andre 3000, I agree with you. I think he's very wrong in that we will have older generations of what we could call overt, explicit, in-your-face racist. That might change a bit, but it's just going to take on a different face. The style of racism will change. But racism itself won't go away because it is fundamentally a structural issue. And now to respond to your point about the shooting incidents, about Chicago versus, say, Aurora or Sandy Hook. And what I find to be the major difference between these two situations is very much the grievance aspect, is that in Chicago, whenever we have incidental violence taking place, it's very much one person or one group of people lashing out at one specific group of people who they have grievances with those specific people. However, whenever we start to look at mass shooters, white male mass shooters, that tends to not be the case. Whenever we have white male mass shooters, they lash out at society in general. It is not, you wronged me, therefore I'm going to take your life. As we would see in some other types of situations, say dealing with gang violence and things of that nature. With these white male shooters, it's a very generalized sense of grievance that society as a whole has wronged them, that society as a whole is not doing its job. And there's a criminological perspective of looking at crime, and it's coined by a man named Donald Black. And it argues that sometimes we have to understand crime as a form of self-help. And what he argues is that people will begin to commit types of crime if they believe that society is incapable of preventing those types of crimes, or if they have a grievance with society and they believe society is not addressing that. And I think that is very much what we see whenever we're looking at these white male mass shooters, is that they believe, because of structural changes that they perceive to have occurred, women's rights, civil rights movement, gay and lesbian rights. But this is very much so infringing on what it has meant to be a white heterosexual male in our society. Whether there are actual structural changes being made doesn't matter. What really matters is the reality that these white heterosexual males are living within. And so they believe, and I put forth an idea in my dissertation called Engineered Vulnerability that kind of deals with this, and that they believe with all of their heart that they are constantly under threat, that they are constantly under some type of attack coming against them. And it's the very thing that's supposed to have protected you and cheered what it meant to be part of your social grouping as a white male is changing, is betraying you, you assume. You want to lash out at society. You will lash out at society in very general terms because that's what's wronging you. So I think if we're comparing and contrasting mass shooting incidents with, say, gang-type violence, it fundamentally comes down to the idea of grievance and the nature of the grievance. And there is the grievance with a specific person, therefore we are acting out against that specific person, or the grievance with the social order itself. Thus, I'm lashing out at society in very general terms.
Again, Dr. Todd Couch. Context of white supremacy. I will read because I thought that was, just your concept where you talk about this imagined vulnerability of white males. You have a portion, this is in the introduction of your dissertation. Vulnerability is theorized as the risk of exposure and loss of control as a construct through which to understand feelings of unsafety. Ignoring the insulation from crime granted by privilege, I argue white males construct a fantasy in which they exist in a state of constant vulnerability to violence, which I term engineered vulnerability. The engineering vulnerability as part of the large white worldview explains not only the exponential increase in gun rights and self-defense rhetoric over the last three decades, but also the homogeneous demographics of almost all gun rights organizations. What do you think is motivated, even if it's not based in reality, if there's actually nothing threatening white males, what do you think is the source of this fear that they could be attacked, they could be subjected to violence, that white males are somehow vulnerable? What do you think is at the root of that?
I think it very much comes down to what it has meant historically to be a white male. And that historically, if we look at what it means to be a white male, you are more or less situated in the dominant position in society, and everyone else is placed in a subordinate position below you. However, if you begin to feel as though those groups are, quote, getting out of place, that those groups are getting out of their natural position, as many would argue, you're going to fight back. There's this fear that they will be usurped by the people they have been dominating for the last several centuries. And that fear is what I believe in many ways motivates this harsh backlash, motivates this very harsh belief that we have to arm ourselves because we have Latino immigrants coming in stealing our jobs. We have black men dating our white women now. And so we have to be able to fight back against that. That the very things that were in many ways guaranteed to white men feel that they are losing access to. They feel that their access to those things is being compromised by structural changes, by progressive social movements. So in many ways, I believe that is very much at the heart of this engineering of vulnerability. But I think a key part of this idea is the fact that these white males are fundamentally out of touch with reality. They are fundamentally removed from empirical reality. They do not understand the way the world actually operates, nor do they understand what their role as white men means in society. They very much so believe that the world is seeking to destroy them, that the world is seeking in some way to take away everything it needs to be a member of their group, to be, some would even argue, to be considered a human being. They believe their very dignity is being taken away by equality type movements.
Huh. When you say that they are out of touch with reality, like first person that came to mind was Congressman Mo Brooks in Alabama. I think in August of this year, he was on a radio program, and he said that there is a war on whites, that quote-unquote
right.
Democrats are that Democrats are waging. And I think he included President Obama as kind of being the keystone of that and Attorney General Eric Holder putting in his resignation.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
saying this and giving out, and a lot of people, I saw the New York Times, they did some articles and some other folks writing and saying, oh, this guy is absurd, he's crazy, he is not in touch with reality. And I thought, I mean, in at least in my view, this, to me, even though it's not rational, even though I agree I don't really see any evidence, right, that white people are under attack, I think there is a long history of white people justifying getting their guns, being violent, practicing racism, exercising really white pathology, in my opinion. There's a long history of them saying, well, we were under attack. We were threatened. I think the broadcast we did last month with the massacre in Slocum, Texas, right at the early 20th century, we had a white person on from that area, and he was talking and he was saying that there's confusion about how it got started, but it seems the foundation of it was some perception that either a black person got a promotion and or talk that black people were going to commit some sort of revolt. And so they had to protect the women and children, and they went out and just started slaughtering black people, estimates that it could have been 200 black people killed easily. And this is over and over and over again. If you check Elliot Jaspin, Buried in the Bitter Waters, these types of incidents where there's some sort of fabricated theory that black people, hordes of black people are coming to kill us all, and we got to go defend ourselves. I think under the system of racism, white supremacy, I think white people need these sort of justifications to practice racism, really. I think that is integral in terms of violence against black people. I think that just seems to be a consistent, really systemic aspect of how racism, white supremacy works. So it's not necessarily that there needs to be authentic data, an authentic justification, right? Black people are plotting to do something, or we are losing power, black people are taking our jobs, whatever the case may be. It doesn't necessarily have to be true, because under this system, whites know that they can lie and easily justify all manner of atrocity. Does that make sense? Am I talking crazy?
No, I think you're exactly correct. And we see this cycle, because that's exactly what it is, it's a cycle, is that periodically, every couple of years, the big bad black man is coming after white folks. And that comes together in many ways to serve, I think it serves a very important function for the maintenance of white supremacy, in that these fictitious myths, that they create a folklore to bring white folks together. It creates a certain narrative in which this very central thing called whiteness becomes the very core of unification amongst white groups who really have nothing else in common. Say, your Wall Street broker versus your dirt farmer, who have nothing in common besides this very little thing called whiteness. But if you're able to speak to that, if you're able to speak to this little thing called whiteness, you can make the dirt farmer forget that he's being exploited by a capitalist economic system, and you can make him align himself very much with the white Wall Street broker under these myths, because that's what they are. But you're right. We see them creep up every now and then, every so many years. There's something going on that, oh, the black folks are coming to, particularly it has a lot to do with white women. These black men are coming to rob our houses and rape our women. Or in more contemporary times, we see it very much dealing with immigration, in that we have immigrants storming across the border. They're going to come take our jobs. They're a threat to our community. Those types of narratives play the exact same function, in that they really serve to define what it means to be a member of this in-group called white. Because one of the big things that we notice in just basic group dynamics in the field of sociology is that a big part of being a membership of the group is defining what it means to be not in that group, as well as attributing certain characteristics to the people who are not in that group. So then creating these myths about treacherous black and Latinos serves to reinforce these social boundaries of life. So I do believe that the alleged war against whites led by Democrats serves that same function, that story serves the very same function, that it creates a narrative to unify whites who may be leaning other political directions and saying, no, don't think that those blacks or Latinos are actually your friends. They're actually after us. We have to come together, and we have to remember that this is who we are. They're trying to take away what it means for us to be members of our group.
I'm remembering that I think that is critical with regards to understanding what it means to be white. And I point this out all the time. So many white people, I would even say including Dr. Fagan, so many white people, they really will get giddy to talk about their benefits, to talk about white privilege, why I encourage people to not use that term. They will love to talk about, well, I can get flesh-colored bandages and the police don't follow me, or they don't ticket me, or they don't do a Michael Brown Jr. Or Daniel Holtzclaw. You know, I don't have to fear that there's going to be some crazy person out raping white women. I don't have to think about all that stuff and blah, blah, blah. But they don't talk about practicing racism. It's been my experience. It's very rare to find a white person who's willing to delineate, these are things I do as a white person, male or female, to practice racism, to mistreat non-white people. And that is core to the practice of racism, white supremacy. In my view, it's core to what it means to be white. And these experiences, this is how you satisfy, this is how you validate your whiteness, what it means to be a white person. And I recall the situation during Hurricane Katrina and the breach of the levees. And it was a perfect example right there. The black rapist, the black looter, black people are going in a situation where black people are in clear need of help and not getting it, drowning. Thousands of people die, more than 1,000, but that's not the dominant narrative. The dominant narrative around the world is black people are baby raping looters who are going crazy. And in that, it gets totally lost that you don't have incidents of black vigilante violence. You have incidents of white racist vigilante violence where at least 11 black people get killed. You can go back in the archives. A.C. Thompson, he was on the program. He did that piece, 18-month investigation in the Nation, where he talked about this. He was able to go down and do this because he is white. But he said, and he got video where white people were barbecuing and laughing about, yes, I killed a black person. It was great. Black person wasn't stealing anything. Black person was unarmed. Nothing. Just living in New Orleans, trying to survive, and they bragged about gunning down and shooting black people, and it was one white man. He said, I was not born here. I was born in the North. They said, this was how I got my white card. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of what he said. You can see the video on YouTube. This is how I validated being a white man. I came down and I got one. And it was at least 11 incidents. Some of these are just random white citizens. Some of these are white enforcement officials. But the exactly what I'm saying, and I, in my opinion, that is very much in touch with the reality as it stands under racism, white supremacy. I know as a white person, male or female, I can kill black. Really, I should look forward to opportunities to mistreat and even kill, rape, whatever, pillage black people. That's what it means. That's really at the core what it means when we're talking about what does it mean to be a white person, what does it mean to be a white man, white woman. In my opinion, and I think that that really gets to the core, I think, of what's driving all this, unless I'm in error. Did you want to respond, or you want to move to a different point? I want to make sure you have opportunity to respond if I've said something crazy or what have you.
No, I think this idea of violence is very important. I think you're right in that it does serve a very important function. For as one author, A.J. William Myers, there for the cultural community of whiteness, that this idea of the practice of violence is a very unifying thing. And I mean, we can look simply as far back as lynchings. Lynchings are a public event, right? You'd have people picnicking and playing baseball while a black guy's being dismembered next to them, right? So it's very much part of the practice. Yeah, I think you're correct, and I think it does serve a function for bringing that group together, for unifying under this umbrella of whiteness. This type of violent backlash is very important.
I even think it's at the core of why Darren Wilson, in my view, he is not going to be charged. I've been saying that for about 2 months now, close to 2 months. He is not going to be charged, and I think this is at the core of why Darren Wilson, at least to what we know, has received about $500,000 in support, saying it happened, murder of Trayvon Martin. This exactly what you're just saying, this unification around violence against black people and this mythology that the black person was a threat or was some sort of criminal that deserved to be.
No, you're exactly right. And these types of incidents, I think you're correct that they won't be prosecuted. There won't be prosecutions done or things of that nature. Because, again, it is a central part of what it means to be a member of that group. It is a central part of it. And I think these incidents are really, really important in illustrating the way in which our society values the lives of people very differently. It fundamentally values the life of people of different races differently. If we had had an incident similar to Ferguson take place with a black officer killing a white suburban child, you can bet that that person would have been taken off the street right then, would have been charges pressed in a very quick fashion. But whenever you switch out the races, it's not the same. All of a sudden, there's a dominant cultural narrative that says, well, this child had robbed a convenience store, allegedly, therefore he deserves to be killed. This child was potentially a bad student in Trayvon Martin's case. He was potentially a bad student, so therefore he deserves what he receives. The discrediting of the victim automatically becomes central to the story. More so than the victim's death, the circumstances around the victim's death. Character assassination accompanies the story almost instantaneously. And so I think you're right, and I think it's important to point out the way that these stories unfold tell us a lot about the ways in which our society values life and the life of people that live within its borders. because I hesitate to use the word citizen to talk about everybody. But, yeah, I think it says a lot about how it values people.
Absolutely. It reflects the values of a system of white supremacy. I think that is absolutely correct. You write, and I want to kind of give people an idea. Some of the folks that you talk to in this Students for Concealed Carry on campus, I thought it was important as well, since we've kind of focused the conversation, I think, accurately on the foundation of this push to be armed, the need to be armed, protect yourself, what is connected to racism, white supremacy. You write, it is difficult to explain why the serious social science literature on gun culture and Second Amendment organizations, after noting that race is an element of their homogenous demographic, continues to minimize a race-based analysis in favor of a more gender-focused approach. This deflects attention away from the importance of white supremacy in modern gun culture. I'd say that is a pattern. Even as I said with the audio clip we started off with, they said there was an increase in these active shootings. They didn't say it's mostly white males who are participating. That tends to be the total opposite. When it's black people doing anything, stealing toothpicks, anything, they make sure to point out black people are going crazy stealing toothpicks or whatever else they allege that we're doing wrong. I just checked the news today to kind of get see, you know, what the current news was. This is just from a few hours ago. Baylor student board okays concealed guns on campus. This is in Waco. Baylor University Student Senate has approved a resolution that would allow students and others who have concealed handgun permits to carry their guns on the Waco campus. That is fascinating in Waco. It still needs approval of the Baylor Board of Regents before it takes effect, and the student body president, Dominic Edwards, could veto the measure over the next 7 days. The school spokeswoman, Lori Fogelman, tells the Waco Tribune Herald that Baylor officials believe allowing the guns would create security challenges. And they do have a white person holding a handgun in the photograph, so that's telling as well. But who are some of these folks that you talked to, and what did they say to you that kind of evidenced that, oh, yeah, this is fundamentally connected to racism, white supremacy, and these white men who want to do this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's interesting to hear that it passed on Baylor's campus. I'm curious to see how it unfolds, and that typically administrative groups tend to be resistant to allowing firearms on campus. They tend to very much resist it because it's bad for the business of colleges to have those types of people running around on campus. But, yeah, it's interesting. But, yeah, I wanted to, since you asked, I wanted to tell you just about a couple of, pull some excerpts, actually, out of my dissertation, so you can actually hear what some of the students that I spoke with are saying. And, again, keep in mind that these are students from all over the country. They're all over the country. I interviewed individuals from almost every state in the nation, aside from Hawaii and Alaska. In the continent, I interviewed almost in every single state. And the thing that was interesting was I did many of them over the phone or over Skype. And the language that they used differed very, very much depending on the medium that I used to conduct the interview. The people who I did the phone interviews with, because they could not see my skin color, it tends to what I look like, they tend to be a little bit more open, honest, and explicit in their language versus those who I did Skype with or in a couple in person interviews tend to use a little more colorblind rhetoric. But I wanted to talk for a second about Bill. And at one point Bill was a guy, I'd asked him to tell me a little bit about gun control laws and their ability to control gun violence. And what Bill told me was, well, you see, gun control is only going to disarm those of us that actually care about doing the right thing anyway. These black kids in downtown won't be impacted at all. I mean, really, these little black kids are going to keep killing each other with illegal guns no matter what. We whites don't do that. We get our guns the right way. We lock them up. We just respect life. That's not the case with them. They really don't care. right? So here, again, we're talking about a 20-something-year-old who has already constructed this narrative of the virtuous white and the evil black person. The white person who gets their guns the right way, they take care of their guns, they like their guns. They value life, as he even tells us. Then you contrast that with a black youth who they don't care. They automatically have their guns immediately. They don't value life. That's just not the case with them. And so these types of stories, I was like, really? This is particularly interesting. This is particularly interesting. Or another man named Garrett that I spoke with, I asked him why being involved in Students for Concealed Carry with camp was important for him. And he told me, Students for Concealed Carry gives me a way for them not to take away my man card. There are faggots everywhere today. These organizations make sure that not every man gets turned into a pussy. Fucking wetbacks are taking our country and blacks are stealing our women. I mean, really, look around any campus in this country and you'll see it. We really don't have anything anymore. Now the government wants to take away our most basic rights. Fuck you, Obama. This is our country. But if you lose the right to bear arms, we'll completely lose everything. So Garrett is much more explicit than even Bill was in telling us, look, this is why I'm part of this organization. I'm in the organization because I believe that without having my firearm, I will cease to be considered a man. And then I will no longer be able to fight back against this myth about the Latino immigrant coming to take economic positions that I could have, or I'm losing white women to black men. And what's interesting is that he points this out as a most basic right. That for him, it's fundamental to his human existence to have access to these types of things. And he feels that they are being impeded on by Latinos and blacks. So pulling from these, I said, wow, this is actually much deeper, much more explicit than I initially thought that it would be. I expected going into it to get much more of the colorblind rhetoric that's very much so characteristic of this day and age. But if they could not tell what I looked like, they were much more likely to speak very open and honest about their intention. And what stuck out to me about this phenomenon that I noticed was, what does it say to us then about gun rights organizations as a place for whites? Is that if you know nothing about me except that I'm interested in your take on firearms, you're comfortable enough with me to speak from very explicitly racist frameworks. What does that lead me to believe about the gun rights organization as a whole? Is the gun rights organization as a whole, within that group, is this explicit framing the norm? Because if it was not the norm, you would be a bit more hesitant with me. Considering you know nothing about me except that I asked you to tell me about firearms, you'd be a bit more hesitant than to talk to me for 5 minutes and then let all of this out. So I think Garrett's statement particularly really gives us a lot of insight into what are the actual frameworks of these groups. What are the actual as Dr. Sagan would put it, what are their frames of reference that they're using? How are they interpreting the world? They're not interpreting it from a post-racial perspective. This idea that millennials don't see race, that's not supported by what we're getting from these students. Based on what I have from students, it is very clear that race is in the center of their mind when they're talking about these types of issues.
Wow, that is fascinating. Dr. Welsing just, came to my mind. Are you familiar with Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and her work, The ISIS Papers?
No, I don't think I've read that.
Wow. She would have
to look that up.
She would have a field day. I think it could contribute to what you're saying. She talks a lot about the gun being the quote unquote great equalizer for white men. And they talk, there's so much rhetoric and narratives, even the castration. She feels that all of that is rooted because white people are a global minority, and just what they classify as white, the skin characteristics and what have you, melanin concentration, that is genetic recessive to black people, dark people, people, so-called people of color. And she feels that that is a key motivator with regards to, that is the motivator for why white people.
Oh, yes. Yes, the Krebs theory.
Yes. Color conference. I feel like that she would have a field day with your work, because she talks about that all the time as the gun being the phallic symbol. And she has been talking for about 6 years and saying the Obama effect, that this is why you see this rash of gun buying where they can't even keep bullets on the shelves once President Obama is elected, and all this rhetoric that he's taking our guns, this symbolic castration because there is a non-white person in the White House, and particularly if they're tying this to, I got to have my gun because that's my man card, and I got to have my gun because all these black guys are taking our women. Like, that is the core of what she's saying with the
right,
the theory of genetic annihilation. Like, I was thinking the whole time, like, wow, when your dissertation is out, she has got to read it, because this is, like, I've been saying that. This is exactly what I've been saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what they believe are being annihilated. That's their concern, is that if you have interracial marriage, you're going to begin to see white numbers drop. You're going to see the significance of, or the influence of whites begin to drop, allegedly. And, yeah, I think the idea of the Krebs theory very much so points us to a better way of understanding this type of backlash, is that, statistically speaking, whites are a very small portion of the world. They're a very small portion of the world. And they have systematically dominated almost every group in the world. And so then when those groups begin in some ways to resist or fight back, or even in the very basic example, simply exist without your foot on their neck, what does that mean to you as a white person? And what does it mean to your position in the social world? So, yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think it's a very good point.
Mm. Context of white supremacy. Joining us live, our guest, Dr. Todd C. Couch. I do see the folks who dialed in who have questions. Man, I'm just thinking of all of that. I have on my Facebook, my picture has been the group at Howard who did the hands up, don't shoot pose. Like, that just has a whole different resonance with the program that we have for the evening. Like, woof, dangerous world we are in. If you have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Couch, feel free. The number to dial, 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you have questions. And just to make sure, I try to always emphasize that this is global. This is what it means to be white. And just further emphasis that we could be having this same conversation in Johannesburg, because this ended up becoming a core of the Oscar Pistorius trial over the last few months. His justification for killing a white woman: we are so afraid because these unruly black people commit crimes, and you just have to be on lookout that they're going to break in and try to rob you or kill you, so you got to have your gun. You got to be ready to defend yourself. His father even came out, Oscar Pistorius, his father came out and blatantly stated that this was the reasoning. This is why this happened, because we are so afraid that black people are going to kill us and break into our houses that we got to be armed. And he thought some black person had broken into the house, and he was ready to defend himself. Just that, you see that same sort of rhetoric, that same frame of reference, that same justification for we got to be armed. They did a documentary short. I was trying to get the filmmaker. She's a white female. It's called Africana Blood, where they have, again, white teens, not Clive and Bundy, not white people who have one foot in the grave. These are white teens, Afrikaners. They are out in full military garb, training, shooting with firearms, military training, because they believe we are not, and they state explicitly, we are not with all of this multiculturalism. Mandela didn't do anything for us. We are Afrikaners, and we are going to defend and protect ourselves as white people. I mean, this is stated very clearly from the mouth of 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds who go out and do armed shooting. That same philosophy, same mindset that you're seeing from these groups with the Students for Concealed Carry on campus. The folks who dialed in, let's see, Mr. M1, if you have a question for Dr. Couch, your line should be open. M1?
Good evening, sir.
Your volume is a little low. I'm not sure what the...
Is that better?
Try again.
Is this better?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay, hi. Good evening. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers, listeners, and good evening to the professor. I was wondering, you mentioned what would happen if a black police officer was to have killed an unarmed white person. Now, I've discussed this case various times, so I'm not going to go into it, but if you want to find out a clear racial double standard, look up Marilyn versus Walker. It just ended this July. It was the case of off-duty black police detective Joseph Walker, who was driving with his family through Maryland when he was set upon by a racist white guy and his friend. And he had to use deadly force against this racist white guy. And I tell you, what Detective Walker was put through was just really fascinating, and what the white racist criminal got, you would think you just did not see. You just do not see in cases when it's white cops against black people. You just do not see it. So either type in Joseph Walker, Joseph Harvey, or Marilyn versus Walker. Now, as for concealed carry, I'm also glad that you mentioned the idea of concealed carry, because my opinion, there's always been this double standard when it comes to a black person asserting self-defense. I mean, you have, like I said, students, schools are predominantly white students having open carry. I believe in Missouri now, You're going to have.
Are you still with us, M1?
Sorry about that. I believe in Missouri, you're going to have open. You're going to have the carrying age lowered to 19. And this is what we are faced against. And also, one last bit on the active shooting. I often state that 80% of active shooters are white guys, and they come from two-parent households. Because as you know, you always hear about the single-parent household, particularly household led by the black mother, being so destructive. How true is that on active shooters coming from two-parent households?
There has not actually been much done looking at that, but I would venture to say that it's not really going to matter a whole lot in terms of the stability of a household and impacting the destructive outbursts of the child. And so I think the dominant cultural narrative about destructive kids come from single-parent households doesn't always hold up. Because in many of the instances with these mass shooters who happen to be minors, they do come from two-parent households. There are some, like the Adam Lanza case in San Diego, where he was an only child, with a single individual parent. But many of the other situations, they come from two-parent households. Or even the situations where we have adults who may be the mass shooter. Many times they come from two-parent households as well. And so in many ways, I think the narrative about the destructive single parents is very much a racially biased narrative, again, used to signal out what it means to be a good family versus what it means to be, this is a destructive family model, where realistically speaking, the stability of the family is much more important than how many parents that you have. The level of emotional commitment within a family, the levels of emotional intimacy within a family is what's much more important than whether or not you have two parents.
Did that answer your question, Imran?
Yes, it has. You can go on.
Good to hear from you, sir. The caller.
Thank you, sir.
Caller at 1184. Did you have a question for Dr. Couch? Your line should be open. Did you have a question for Dr. Couch? Or are you just listening? Not hearing. If you have a question, you can let us know if something was happening with your line as well. Our co-host, Justice, no relation. Do you have any questions for Dr. Couch? Your line should be open.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi to everybody and the guest. I'm just listening for now. Thank you, though.
All right. Cool. If other folks have questions, feel free to dial in. We'll get your hand. Try not to hang out, wait till the last minute. We got some of the statements, I guess, before I move forward. Were there any other statements that were as direct and straightforward as some of the content that you shared earlier that really made it clear that the root motivation for getting this concealed carry was the threat of black people, the threat of non-white people?
Sure. At one point, let me pull another note for you. I had discussed with a young man named Dylan. I had talked to him. I wanted to understand basically what were the activities that the organization was involved in. Because as with most student organizations, they get together frequently and will do various activities on weekends, things of that nature. And so I asked a young man named Dylan, tell me what are some of the different things that your organization does. And he told me, he said, we shoot, when he laughed. We're not really the type of folks to do wine and cheese socials. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's just not who we are. He said, but we do spend a good amount of time at the firing range. And I asked him, can you tell me about that? He goes, well, that's once we get there, we decide to shoot and we go at it. And I asked him, so what is it that you shoot? Do you shoot targets? Do you shoot clay pigeons or whatever? He says, yes, there are some pretty cool targets out there right now. The place that I go to has some that look like Mexican immigrants. Some look like the Mexican army. We had old ones that looked like Obama. We would even put hoods on some of ours right after things like the Trayvon Martin, just because those guys are kind of looking like thugs, and those are the people who are more likely to attack us. So we want to be prepared. Then I asked him to go back and tell me a little bit more about the immigrant that he discusses. He says, you know, it just looks like some kind of wetback. He goes, that probably sounds fucking racist to talk, but it's just an illegal immigrant. He goes, you know, they're coming over here with guns and drugs, so we have to be prepared for them because they do that stuff. It's just basic shit for them. So in that statement again, we see this very central narrative that even when they come together to have fun, kind of pulling back to the statement you made earlier about getting the wife, car, and that nature, the leisure time for these groups centers around practicing racial assault in certain ways. And that's what they do to come together. So the major reason in wonder, I wanted to ask you this, that it would have compromised my interview with you, but is it any wonder then that you don't have any people of color joining your organization, even trying to join your organization, if these are the types of activities that you regularly engage in? I think not at all. It's not a surprise then. Or another man I spoke with named Richard. Richard, he was explicit with his, but also he was a little bit colorblind with it. And I think that is important because that's really the type of conversations that I got the most of. And I think it's the most of what we're going to get from contemporary millennials. They're not going to be as in your face with it as other generations would have been, because in many ways it goes against the political correctness of our era. But I'd asked Richard to talk to me a little bit about racial profiling, and he told me there's been a lot of talk nowadays about racial profiling, and people want to get all pissed off about it. Listen, I know it's not politically correct to say, but I'm all for profiling people. You have to if you want to protect yourself. If I see someone who looks like they're up to no good, with their pants off their ass, looking like they're all fucked up off some shit, do you think I'm going to keep an eye on them? You're damn right. I never even owned a gun until I moved to Townsville. And the area I lived in, and he took a really long pause, he said, it was like boys in the hood. Then he kind of chuckled and says, you know, they had loud music and drop down cars and all that kind of shit. Now, so many of these people just dress like that, and they'll probably get profiled for it, and that sucks for them, but it's what I have to do to ensure my safety. So Richard really gives us a different style of really saying the exact same stuff. And you can tell that he wanted to say something else when he begins to tell me about the neighborhood he moved into, because this was actually an in-person interview. Well, it was on Skype so you could see my face. So rather than saying, I moved to this place that had like a lot of black folks in it, he tells me it looks like boys in the hood. But if you tell me your neighborhood looks like boys in the hood, I know exactly what you're saying, right? Then he puts even talking about people who are saggy. But he's really describing all of these stereotypes of black males and Latino males in some ways. But these are the people why he decided to purchase a gun in the first place. He'd never had a gun, didn't have an interest in a firearm until then. That's what made him want to not only get involved in the organization, but purchase a firearm and believe that he needs to carry it at all times. It's essentially motivated by being in a community with black and brown bodies. And I think that's very telling of the ways in which we're seeing the justification for decisions to arm oneself. But one thing that was worth noting was within the organization, there's actually a group of students within the group, and they all share a very common thread in that they all tend to be military veterans. The people who had been in any type of military service joined the organization for a very small period and then backed out of it very fast. They did not want any part in the type of narrative that were going on within the organization. They didn't want any part of what they essentially considered just the racism in the organization. They believed without a doubt that this was a white supremacist organization. And one guy I spoke with, he was a former Marine, and he had done several tours in Iraq. And he told me that I asked him why he became involved with the organization. Because I could tell when I began speaking with him that it was a very different vibe from him than from the other people. It was not, I'm necessarily an angry, you know, middle-class white guy. It was a very different vibe from him. And I said, well, tell me why you got involved with SCC, because you're really pretty different than anyone else I've spoken with. He was to tell me, one of my buddies in the Marine Corps started here last year at some of the school and wanted to get involved in SCC. And I told him, Cortez, you don't want any part of that fuck shit. He knew what I meant. Cortez is Guatemalan, and with all the rant from the kids in SCC do here about immigration, you know they would not want him in there. They even dress their targets up in sombreros sometimes. What the fuck is that? I would even discourage you from joining, talking about me, because, again, he could see me. You seem like you're really interested and knowledgeable about Fifth Carry and stuff, but honestly, they really don't want you there. I mean, they would never say anything to you or anything like that, but I'm sure when you weren't there, they would call you the N-word. To be real, man, if you don't look like them, you don't want to be there. So, this is somebody who joined the organization, told me he joined the organization because he wanted to just kind of keep doing some of the things that he didn't like in the military. Then his friend asked him about it, and he said, don't do it because you're not going to fit in if you're not part of that little white middle-class male group, because their motivations are not really about firearm sports. It's about arming themselves for a specific cause. And very similar, Tyler tells us that the people in his chapter that he was briefly a part of, they would even dress their targets up at the range in sombrero, similar to the things Dylan told me that his group did as well. So it's not an isolated event. Rather, it appears to be a fairly common thing taking place with this organization in that they know what they're preparing for. They know why they're arming themselves, and they want to be able to practice. And they want to be able to shoot things that they believe look like what it is they're actually planning to shoot. And that's what's particularly troubling about this organization, is that it is well thought out. And they practice this type of barbarism. That's the thing that's rather terrifying about this organization.
Before we map some of the other folks who have questions, just vitally important in my opinion, the point you made about the bonding aspect of this, like we get together, we go to the gun range, we shoot targets in hoodies, or that our representations of President Obama, or we put sombreros on them, what a quote-unquote wet mat looks like, and this is their bonding activity. This is how we fraternize. Imagine ourselves slaughtering non-white people. It reminds me when Dr. Fagan was a guest on the program, and we talked about his book, Two-Faced Racism, which is in my top 10, where he's got all those vignettes of racist jokes. And I said, that to me reveals so much, because in my view, that's one of the few times where you get to hear white people speak honestly about racism. And those jokes, I've said it consistently, they reveal the values, the codes. This is how you are supposed to think. This is, I mean, if you want to talk about what is your worldview, what is the racist white frame, listen to racist jokes. They will give it to you as clean as you can possibly imagine. And so many of those racist jokes are focused on violence against black people. And black people specifically, not, you know, just any not, black people specifically. And I even, one of the ones that we talked about, he said it was, how do an apple and President Obama, what do they have in common, an apple and President Obama? And the punchline is they both look good hanging from a tree. And there are tons of these. They've got tons of them. And the vast majority of them, violence against black people, I said, since this is a racist joke, what you're telling me then is for whites, practicing violence against black people is fun. This is entertainment. This is amusement. And as you said before, the lynching pictures suggest that. This type of conduct suggests that we are supposed to have fun and enjoy ourselves to the highest when we get to practice violence, even kill black people. And that just seems to be another illustration. You get another one tomorrow, Richard Williams, Black and White, the way I see it, this will pop up again. And also, just that self-editing that happens. We had a guest on the program before, and she was saying she had two black parents, but she was very pale. She almost looked like, you know, she might be able to pass or definitely looked like she might have a great parent. But she was doing research on racism, and she was going to talk to white professors in person. And she said, number one, she cited the research that shows that it's difficult when you talk to white people about racism because they will not be truthful. They will do a lot of self-censoring so that they don't appear
right.
racist. And even there's, I guess, newer literature that shows that this is still in effect. Even if it's a white person talking to another white person, they still will do a lot of self-editing if they're talking about racism. And I said that is another, for me, evidence. That's another piece of evidence to illustrate that white people are not ignorant about racism. You can't self-censor if you don't understand race. And I mean, clearly these folks do not sound ignorant just because of the things that they're doing. But to know, I was going to say, you know, whatever he was going to throw
right.
out, this is a nigger neighborhood or whatever he would typically say to edit. Dr. Fagan, he says, you go from the backstage to the front stage, just knowing that there's a different way that you can talk about black people, non-white people, if I'm around all white people, as opposed to when I'm out in public, just that alone. You are not ignorant about racism. This is something that you understand. Dr. Curry and I, we talked about that the last two times he was on the program, that is such an insidious lie. And I feel like that really hampers non-white people's ability to accurately solve this problem because we're constantly thinking that this is a manifestation of ignorance. These people that you're talking to, they're just ignorant about racism. No, they are experts. They thoroughly understand what it means to be white and how they're supposed to behave, even down to, better not say that. I can save this for when I'm at the group, when we're at the gun range. I'm not going to say this
right.
to Dr. Couch because he might think I'm a racist or they might think I'm a racist. That happens all the time with white people. The question I wanted to ask, all of this, you know, preparing for the day when I will have to gun down a black person or a wetback or whatever the case may be, did any of these people say that they ever had any history of actually being harmed or mistreated by a black person or a non-white person, period?
Never.
Wow.
That's the thing, right, is that was something that just stuck out even when I was talking about this idea of vulnerability. And it's the only group of the people I spoke with who talked about having any real incident take place in their life that I can justifiably say, okay, you might need to have a firearm, where the two white women that I spoke with had both been victims of rape and attempted rape. And so they, even in their conversations, though, they actually didn't use racialized rhetoric as much as the men did. The white women that I spoke with talked about being raped, and the other person had an attempted rape, and so that's the reason she wanted to have a firearm. Okay, so be it. But the males I spoke with had never had any incident take place, ever. That was one of the questions I asked them. I said, hey, have you ever been in an incident where you would have needed your firearm and then did not have it? Or have you ever been in a situation where you had to draw your firearm in a defensive situation? Never. They've never been in those types of situations. So, again, it's completely fictional. It's completely fantasy for these guys. And one man I spoke with, he compared it in many ways to the video games that he plays, telling me that he has lots of different silencers, that he has tons of different rifles, and that he has rehearsed in his mind the possible different ways that he could use them. So he's waiting for someone to invade his house just so he has the excuse to do it.
Wow. Man. Pause for Ted Wafer. Wow. And I think that was almost stated verbatim in the trial for the death of Radisha McBride, that he was upset that there had been some vandalism in the neighborhood, and he had his shotgun, and he said he was full of piss and vinegar, and it seemed he was waiting for the opportunity to use his shotgun. Wow.
Or I just pulled up the guy's statement. His name was Walt. And I was asking him about the importance of owning firearms and his newfound love for silencers. And he told me, he said, "I'll be honest with you, man, I own a lot of firearms. It's pretty much a little arsenal right now." And he just laughed and said, "I've really lost count. My latest thing has become silencers. I just got this one really badass one the other day. I don't want them to know I'm coming. That's important when you're dealing with a lot of targets at once. Any noise will set them off to your location, and you can't afford for them to know. It's just like the Navy SEALs. When they go in, they have their silencers so they can remain invisible to target. It's just like SOCOM. It's the same when it comes to your family. If a group was to break in, you would never know it. And I'm taking out their buddy before they even know I'm taking their head next." All right, so he's talking about, and this guy was not a veteran. He was a 19-year-old sophomore. He was not a veteran, but he had this fantasy of himself as a Navy SEAL in the video game SOCOM, where he has silencers and he can take people out, and they'll never know that he's coming. And he's rehearsed this in his mind so many times that he's looking forward to it. Wow.
Woo. I will pause so that I can gather my thoughts. The person who dialed in last 4 digits, this is our caller in Alabama. Caller in Alabama, some of the other folks have questions. I will nab you as well. Caller in Alabama, did you have a question for Dr. Couch?
Yes.
Your volume is low.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you hear me clear?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay, I had a question for Dr. Couch. Do you think it could probably be that, like, not just that they are, like, imaginary, like, imagining all these type of people who going to attack them as the group of evil white people they are, I would say oppressive white people. Let me erase the word evil. I would say oppressive white people that they are. Do you think instead of like imagining, do you think it could be like they like running drills? Like, you know, in his mind he sees himself as some like SOCOM soldier or, you know, a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret type of guy. But he is imagining correctly. He's a race soldier. And could it be that they are really like running drills? Like, you know, you run a fire drill in school. 9 times out of 10, you're not going to have a fire drill. I mean, you ain't going to have no fire at the school. You're probably going to get towed down with bulldozers and stuff like that. But they run those drills, so once they do, actually, like if we do try to revolt, or if one day they decide to, you know, call us, because I don't think they will, they're really trying to wipe us all the way out, because they could do that if they want to right now. But like if they one day they say, okay, we're going to cull the population a little bit, and it's just all hands, like that movie where you kill somebody in debate time. I forgot what the movie called. They wouldn't know what it's called?
The Purge.
Yeah, The Purge. But like if they have like, you know, one little purge where they like, okay, we're going to cull the black population out. You see what I'm saying? like they did in Rosewood, et cetera, et cetera. But they just have those training drills to make sure that they are proficient at killing. You know, they make sure they are proficient at killing. So could it be that they're not imagining people are attacking them? That's what they say to the general world, but they just are running drills, and they are race soldiers, not imaginary soldiers. They are actual race soldiers. And my last question would be, because it's a group of questions, last question would be, what is the mental state of a group of people who know they have an enemy like this, and we don't have, like, nationwide militias or even global-wide militias ourselves, you know, doing this, like, in every state? You know, it should be like a lot of them. Like, what do you think the mind state of us is as a people if we don't have that? Do you think that we think it couldn't happen, or what? I don't, just mute my line and continue to listen along. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you made a really excellent point. Hitting your second point first, I think many black people, I don't think there's a mental defect. I don't think that's the issue. I think the fundamental racial double standard when it comes to access to firearms, that's the issue. Because any time we have a decent number of black folks get guns, they get killed. Some of the very first gun rights legislation helped draft by the NPR, not the NPR, the NRA, by the NRA, was to take guns away from the Panthers. So whenever we have black groups get firearms and begin training or even simply just standing outside with firearms, they automatically become dangerous. They automatically receive very heavy scrutiny from the government. They automatically are viewed as threats to the rest of society, and they're killed in many instances. So I think when it comes to what do black people do given the situation they find themselves in, dealing with the fact that white folks in some areas are arming themselves and preparing for these and running these drills, because I think drills is actually a really good way to put that. I think black people find themselves in a very difficult situation. And that if you were to have a group on campus of, say, black students, Latino students, maybe Asian American students, coming together saying, look, we just want to practice our firearm safety too. We just want to get together and shoot as well. They would be very heavily scrutinized by the university, by the government, because they would be considered a threat, as has almost always been the case in U.S. history, whenever we have people of color arming themselves in considerable numbers. So I think the thing is, black people are in a very difficult situation, and in some way possibly have their hands tied as to what response can be made. What response can be made to these types of small militia groups. To your first point dealing with the drills, I think this concept of a drill is very interesting. I think it's very useful too, because while we can say that from a very structural position, understanding the way that white supremacy is a global system, that the likelihood of black folks just overrunning the U.S. is incredibly small. The likelihood of Latinos coming in and just destroying the economy isn't going to happen. It's fantasy for these white men in that way, but they're living in that world. They live in that fantasy land, or as one author puts it, this consensual hallucination. They're living in that world where now they have to be race soldiers. They have to be race soldiers. So when they're at these firing ranges shooting at President Obama's picture, shooting at paper targets with sombreros, they're running drills. And that's the reason why they're putting those sombreros on, because they believe that's what the people they're going to have to shoot actually look like. They believe the people that they're actually going to have to shoot wear sombreros. They believe the people that they're actually going to have to shoot wear hoodies. They believe those are the people. So I think they all are running drills, because in their world, they are race soldiers. And, again, we heard in the statement I gave a second ago about Walt, this parallel that they're making to SOCOM and Navy SEAL-type video games, they see themselves in the same way. They see themselves in much of the same way. So they are running the drills. I think drills is a very good way to understand what we're observing with these organizations.
Right on. Let's see, the caller at 1-388-1388, did you have a question for Dr. Couch? Your line should be open.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Right, Foreman.
Doing well, sir.
Hey, I've been in and out on the conversation, but I did hear you mention that the white group, the guys, are their motto is, I guess, they're prepared, not paranoid. Is that what you were saying earlier?
Yes, sir. That's one of their big platforms.
Okay. And with the last major events been going on also, too, with non-white people, black men, I heard you just mention something about the double standard also, too. How do you get in the minds of non-white black men to have that same philosophy, being prepared for what may come about? And even so, with that group, with your study also, too, have you heard anything of, like, the FBI infiltrating that group or classifying them as, you know, homegrown terrorists or something like that? Because I know there's a double standard if black men did that in large groups across the country also, too. I'm pretty sure the government, the FBI, someone would infiltrate and then want to label us as homegrown terrorists or something like that. But if we use that same philosophy, we're being prepared, not paranoid. How do you get around something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to my knowledge, the federal government has no interest in this organization whatsoever. They simply view them as a Second Amendment organization, no different than the NRA or any other gun rights group. So they are not under any type of scrutiny. And just to kind of give you all of you an idea about their size, they say that they have 40,000 members. So just think, wow, if you have 40,000 black folks around the nation arming themselves for this, you would get a very different backlash. You would have government infiltration instantaneously if you had 40,000 black folks around the nation arming themselves, preparing for this war that they believe is coming, these impending threats that they believe are always present. And they put forth, the organizations have the narrative, prepared, not paranoid. And actually, on my title, I put a question mark after that, because I was really kind of interrogating that idea about, are y'all really paranoid? Is that what's really taking place? Because in many ways, when I was asking about this model, it was one of my primary questions, was asking the students, hey, you know, explain this to me. What does it mean? They would often compare being armed at all times to having, say, a fire extinguisher in your house, wearing your seatbelt in your car. They say it's no different, that it has to be a fundamental part of your everyday life that you don't even think about. But you do it largely because you believe that at any moment, something can jump off. At any moment, somebody will try to murder you. At any moment, somebody will try to rape your significant other. So you must always be prepared. So if we had, again, black folks doing this, who statistically are much more likely to have those same events actually happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
If we had black folks doing it, the government would be all over it, and they would consider them homegrown terrorist organizations.
Also, I got to also think, well, I spoke to a lot of people about black men also, too, about being prepared for what might happen given, you know, the context of what's been happening, you know, in the past years where, you know, you got the police, Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, were being targeted and saying being prepared. I get a lot of backlash from people that I speak to. They say, man, we don't need no guns, man. We killing each other already. So, you know, to prepare ourselves, we're not disciplined enough to arm ourselves. No way, we don't need no guns. So on the flip side of that, they'd rather, you know, be targeted or hunt down and then don't want to arm themselves at the same time, but they'll still complain that we're being targeted. What would you say to people like that?
Oh, boy.
It's crazy because I get a lot of people who say that. You know, I say, man, you need to be prepared out here. You might want to get your gun for your household or something like that. Then they just say, man, we black folks don't need no guns. We killing each other. All these shooting in Chicago, New Orleans, you know, Philadelphia, things like that. And they feel less guns will stop the black-on-black violence. But they don't want to be prepared for the terror that the dominant society has been bringing to us, you know, since we were embarked on these slave ships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that speaks to really two real big issues, in that on one hand, because of the issues in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, things of that nature, there has been within the black community a very large desire to distance from arming oneself just because of the very negative outcomes that we observe in those places. And that the belief that if we can get firearms and things off the streets, if we can stop taking up arms and things of that nature, it will help the community at large. And I think that's where much of the resistance comes from. But I still think that the big issue that we would run into if we were to have black people begin to take up arms for prepared, not paranoid reasons, right? If they took it up for those same reasons, the government intervention that would come with that, because that's been the case historically. Whenever black people fight back, they get killed. Whenever black people fight back, they're killed. And so I think it's a very difficult situation that black people find themselves in. Because if you want to fight back and you want to resist, you know that it takes time to develop that type of organization, that type of movement. Well, historically, whenever we had those types of movements begin to develop in their very early stages, they're left out by the FBI. So then, again, black people find themselves in a very difficult situation as far as what do you do. So I really think that there's two big points in that the amount of violence that we do observe, gang-type violence, things of that nature, has made people very cautious about taking up arms. And understandably so. But on the other hand, if black people were to take up arms, given the historical precedent, we know pretty much exactly what would happen, is that while the movements were developing, they would be infiltrated by the FBI and the CIA, and the people involved with it would be killed. That answers your question?
Oh, yes, it answers the question.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be infiltrated, but have you, in your book, have you ever labeled or have you ever just seen, you know, white young men being classified as terrorists with the mass shooting? And I haven't seen any, you know, footage of them classifying as an act of terror when they go into a movie theater and shoot up someone or shoot up a crowd or things of that nature. I still haven't seen that just being classified as terroristic acts committed by, you know.
Across the board, we very generally see, if you survey every time that the media refers to somebody as a terrorist, they're not white folks. You can have a person who's white do one act and a person say who is black do the same act, and the black person is much more likely to be labeled as a terrorist. It's just the case. The only time we can really observe a white person being labeled as a terrorist is with the Boston Marathon situation. But even with the Boston Marathon situation, he was only considered a suspect. He was considered a criminal until they found out that he was not an American white person. Then they switched the language to terrorist. When they found out that he was not a native U.S. white person, the language shifted to now he is all of a sudden a terrorist. Because terrorist really is not a term used for white folks. It's just not. It's something that is typically reserved for non-whites. It's typically reserved for people who do not reflect the establishment. So I think that's a very, very smart thing to pick up on. That's very wise.
Appreciate your questions. Call at 1-3-8-8. Wanted to double check, make sure I didn't miss a listener. The caller 8179. Did you have a question for Dr. Couch? Or are you just listening? Caller 8179.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thanks for coming on the show. I did have a question at first, but it sounded like you answered it. But just for clarity, this is not an exclusive club and this or organization, and they are on the surface advocating just safety. Is that what that is? And are there any non-whites, any other ethnicities that you were able to interview, or I just wanted to know on that,
sure.
You know, just those questions.
Sure. Yeah, on the surface level, they are a Second Amendment organization group who believe that students should have the right to protect themselves at all times. Similar to many other gun rights organizations, they believe that the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. That's something I heard a million times while I was collecting data with them, was that that was the only thing that could protect them. So they are very much presenting themselves as a group that is there centrally for safety, that they believe they're the people who can save the university from all the bad incidents that could possibly happen. But as far as actually being able to speak with anyone who was not, that was not a white student, it was incredibly difficult. They often brag about the diversity of their organization because I asked them. I said, can you tell me a little bit about the demographics of your group? And they would always tell me how diverse their group was. They said, we have women, we have lots of women, we have a couple black guys, a couple Latino guys, they would say. But I never found these people. I was able to find these groups through public forums, and I would look at their photos, and I didn't see anybody that was not a white male. I never saw them. Every now and then, I would see a white female, but I never saw one black male, never saw one black female, never saw any Latinas. I never saw them. They never responded to anything. Their group, you could go through and look at their members. When I looked at who their membership was, I never saw black men or women. I never saw any Latinos. I was only able to actually interview one male who was a Latino. I interviewed one Latino male. out of all of my interviews, I was able to get a hold of him. But he was my only example. He was the only time that I had somebody else who was not a white male be willing to discuss the subject matter with me. And with him, he was an immigrant from Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And you notice that part of him trying to assimilate very much to white America, trying to assimilate to dominant culture, he very much bought into this anti-black, even anti-immigrant narrative in many ways. But he was my only example. Typically, it is almost an exclusively white male organization.
Real quick, too, I wanted to ask, did you ask or did they discuss their recruiting process? Or, like, say, for instance, I was interested. Like, how do I approach that?
Sure. Their number one recruiting method was something called tabling, which basically they would take a fold-out table into the quad of the university. They would have flyers. They would have a couple of banners. And they would have one or two of the officers from the organization sit there and be available if somebody wanted to come by and see them. That's the primary thing they did. They typically did not do anything besides that. They would, sometimes on their group, on their listservs, they would send out information about people going to the range. But as far as just from a simple student perspective, if you were a student and wanted to know more about them, you had to go to their table whenever they would set their stand-ups.
Okay, thank you. I'll mute my line. Thanks for sharing the information.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
I don't mind. Just two quick points. Number one, I had a big laugh with the Boston bombing situation. Not that that's humorous, but that I had talked about how I was not sure he was a white person. We even had a program, if folks remember, that Mr. Tsarnaev is Caucasian, not white. When we had a white professor on, she was explaining that she does not think he was accepted as a white person, but neither here nor there. When you share that there are roughly 40,000 members of this Students for Concealed Carry on campus, that is about twice the size of Ferguson, just for folks to kind of put that in perspective, that number of people. I thought it was super important when you shared that, you know, just let's be truthful. If black people tried to do this, if there were 40,000 black people doing this, there would be a radically different response from federal government, President Obama or no. It would be a radically different response. And I think that's important because just tying together some of the things that you shared about this, this is a galvanizing effort for white people practicing racism and particularly being violent against non-white people, especially black people, that it seemed that white people were imagining vignettes and different scenarios where they could go out and kill black people, whether it was some imagined threat or whatever the circumstance, but where they would have an opportunity to kill a black person, almost like trying out their toys. Just kind of putting all of that together, and that this seems to be video games. Again, this is supposed to be something that is enjoyable, entertaining to go out and commit violence against non-white people. With the situation in Ferguson, I heard, I think it was last week, they had a town hall in St. Louis, and people were talking about the event in Ferguson, and it was a black person was reported to have said, if things don't go correctly, if Officer Wilson isn't charged, indicted, convicted, there's going to be payback. There's going to be violent payback, was suggested in his response. And in fact, Dr. Welsing, when she was a guest on our program a few weeks back, she said she's of the opinion that white people want us to riot. That way they will be justified in pulling out their tanks, all kinds of their fatigues, their arm gear. They can get saddled up to go out and aggressively deal with black people and be justified in doing so. And even we had a white male on the program. He's a sheriff in San Francisco County. He said that he was at a seminar with his fellow officers, and it was a white woman. She said, hey, those people are out there acting like animals. They need to be dealt with. That's what you're supposed to do. If they're going to go out there and be those type of savage hooligans, then that's the way they're supposed to get dealt with. Given, I guess, what you've studied, what these folks have said, does it seem like perhaps with this Ferguson situation that this could be, hey, go ahead, get riled up, go out, loot, shoot, whatever, and then we'll be riled up? Does that seem logical? Does that seem like something that would follow that pattern of white people then being justified to go out and use their concealed carry?
Well, I think that's what we observed when we saw the way that Ferguson was unfolding, was you had blacks protesting, and then you had militarization happen. That was the result of any type of black mobilization. Even peaceful mobilization warrants mobilizing in military form. And so I think there may be some truth to that. There could possibly be truth to, okay, we're going to let this group get wild, riled up, and then we're going to use all of our new toys that we got. I could see that potentially happening. One thing about the size of students for concealed carry is they say that they have 40,000 students. I don't know where those 40,000 are. Based on my estimates of everything I saw, it was closer to about 10,000. Most of the campus chapters that I was able to get a hold of had no more than maybe 5 to 10 people. So I think they overestimate their numbers, but they say they have 40,000 people. I think it's much less than that. But again, they are a force on many, many college campuses. And kind of where I came out at the end of everything was, college administrators have to be very concerned about allowing that on their campus, but not allowing concealed carry, because if we understand who these people are that want to carry, why they want to carry, and generally speaking, there's a trend of increased diversity across college campuses, if we're having more black and Latino men on campus, what does allowing concealed carry mean in terms of their safety? What does it mean in terms of the safety of our black students? So.
Wow. With are you seeing a connection? Because I know over the last couple of weeks there was a news report. There was an incident, a so-called flash mob in Tennessee, where some white grocery store workers, it was videoed, where they were attacked by a group of young black people. There were lots of calls, particularly what they call right-wing radio, saying, hey, why isn't Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, why aren't they down here talking about this incident? And isn't this a hate crime? And where is Eric Holder saying that white people are being attacked? Colin Flaherty, he's a white male. He wrote the book, he's been a guest on our program as well, where he talks about white people are under, there's a war on white people. White people are being attacked all the time by black people, and nothing is being done about it. President Obama won't talk about it. Eric Holder won't talk about it. News won't even cover it. This happens all the time, and it just gets totally ignored, where we are just under siege right now, if you're a white person. And I even feel that this is kind of weaving into some of the popular television programs, The Purge, I'd say, for example, or Walking Dead, even Breaking Bad, where, again, you have this white male character who has been aggrieved. The world just hasn't lived up to what he's supposed to get, his expectations as a white man. It's not working out. He doesn't have the power. He doesn't have the acclaim that he's supposed to, which then justifies him being violent, really mostly against non-white people. I think several folks have pointed that out, that most of the people that Walter White kills are non-white people, even his chief nemesis being a black male. Are you seeing a kind of, even in kind of pop culture and major themes on television and what have you, and these narratives of white people being under attack? There was a lot of that even after 2012, after Trayvon Martin was killed. like Alex Jones and other folks saying all of these retaliation crimes where white people are being attacked, with black people saying this is for Trayvon. Are you seeing that kind of narrative push this imagined vulnerability where white people are feeling like they're under attack or could be some threat looming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the purge is actually a very good subject matter, in that I think it, I like to look at the purge a bit as satire as well. I like to look at the purge, but I think it points to the underlying message is very important, in that if you were to allow an event like this to take place, you know how it would go down. If you were to allow murder to be legal for 12 hours, you would have, without a doubt, the systematic genocide of black people taking place during those 12 hours. And I think the purge very much pushes that idea that if this is what we had, this would more than likely be the outcome. And I think, kind of going off your other points, I think these stories about these flash mobs beating up, killing white children, white college students, they serve very much that myth purpose of bringing communities together. And there's an outcry. Several colleagues that I know had let me check out an article about a student who was at Texas A&M University and was beat up by several hundred black students at a McDonald's. I know where that McDonald's is. You can't fit several hundred black people on that block, right? But it makes a really nice narrative for white supremacy, in that we had just a white kid going to getting a sandwich, and all of a sudden, for no reason, several hundred black guys just lash out at him and beat him up, and he's a dying. It makes no sense. The narrative makes no sense, but it's not supposed to. It doesn't have to. That's not its purpose. Its purpose is to get someone fired up. It's no different than a political candidate speech. That's the purpose it serves, is to get people fired up, and that's exactly what it does. And so I think it is something that we are seeing across the board in many areas. There's a very neoconservative backlash that's saying, look, white men are being targeted, white people in general are under siege by people of color across the board. And I think that is I think it's something we want to continue to see. As we continue to observe different structural rearranging taking place, these types of backlash-style narratives will only continue to increase, I believe.
Context of white supremacy. I completely agree. I had two more questions I wanted to get in. Do we have time for me to get in two more?
Sure.
Right on. When I mentioned yesterday, and just for listeners, I think purge is extremely important as well. Both the latest version and the one that came out last summer, I found it. I wrote about it. I even did a video segment about it, and just saying that for a film, I think the budget was less than well under $10 million. This wasn't even a film that they invested very much in, and it made over $60 million. Last year, and prompted them to do a sequel for a film like that, where the plot is centered around a mob of whites, males and females, attempting to track down an unarmed black person and kill them, where that's the plot of this film that ends up making $60 million kind of out of nowhere. And it's really centered around a white family helps him, and they pay the price, which I think is an important theme as well, that if you are the right person, you are not supposed to help black people. We are supposed to be unified in this, and if you are not going to unify in this, well, then we'll just treat you like we do the niggers, and you can die too, which is pretty much what plays out in The Purge. I thought, number one, the incident when I was saying yesterday, I think some of the listeners that they didn't initially grasp why I was surprised that your study was millennials, young white people that allegedly voted for President Obama and are not racist, they said the incident that just happened with the 9-year-old white female, she was at the gun range and killed the instructor, they said that just listening to a lot of the commentary, and I know I heard some myself, where white people were justifying young people being at a gun range, even as young as 9, being at a gun range and shooting, it wasn't, oh, my God, what was she doing in the first place? This is ridiculous. Can we at least get legislation, you know, to make sure that this never happens again? We don't have someone that it was, well, you know, a lot of us, we do want to train our children. That was a lot of the narrative that, well, I'm not saying that this is bad. We just need to make sure that we do it in a better manner. And they had several white gun range owners on different podcasts, and they said, hey, we have children at our ranges all the time. We just restrict the type of guns that they can use, and lots of parents, they bring their children in. We have 9-year-olds, we have 10-year-olds. Some even said that they had younger than that coming in and training with a firearm. And our listener, he said that to him, that is huge because it's very likely that they have the same mentality as the folks that you spoke with for students for concealed carry on campus, that we are even training our white urchins to be prepared to shoot a Trayvon Martin or a wetback, that's the mentality, and that's why you see a defense of this sort of event where the 9-year-old kills the gun instructor. What are your thoughts?
No, I think that was a very good thing to pick up on, is that the commentary afterward by generally white conservatives was, oh, yeah, it's sad that it happened, but, you know, kids need to learn how to shoot. That's the response that we get, which is rather odd of all things. It's an incredibly odd type of feedback to receive. But I think for that population, they see this need to have little kids arming themselves, little kids prepared to shoot all types of artillery. It's critical to their existence. It's critical to their functioning within society. So it's from a very early age instilling these fear-based narratives into young people. So I think it plays a very important socialization purpose in that it socializes these children to view certain people in certain ways, to believe that you need to interact with certain people on certain terms, that you need to know how to shoot, that is a fundamental requirement. And, I mean, it's sad for the family of the instructor who was shot that, you know, we can't even have an honest conversation about safety at a gun range because all the other stuff supersedes it. We have to arm our kids because the looming threats are everywhere.
Absolutely. That's even in The Purge, where they have white children being comfortable with firearms and going out and doing this shooting as well. I wanted to throw in, just because I was looking at your resume online and looking at some of the presentations that you've done over the years, several of them caught my eye. AIDS telling the disclosure and assessment factors related to delivery of bad news on some of your other reports. I was especially caught Boondocks, animating the black experience. We have talked about the Boondocks before. A very important program, just I think came to its last season. It's so much I could say about that. If I had to jump to two points, I would jump to the specific episode from season 4, Freedom, Ride or Die, where it's a flashback. For people who haven't seen it, you have to watch that episode. Reading is more important than watching television when Dr. Couch's dissertation comes out. You should read that. That is way more important than watching the Boondocks. That being said, if you do follow the Boondocks, that is an episode that you should watch. I'm even more intrigued because the first time I saw it, I was cracking up laughing. And it's important for a lot of reasons. They have Julian Bond in it, and I took one of his classes when I was at University of Virginia, so that was wild for a lot of reasons as well. But that particular episode, I watched it with a 10-year-old, and it's mm-hmm. kind of a satire. They're poking fun at the authentic freedom rides that happened during the 60s, and it's even set up. They have a documentary by the same name, and they set it up exactly like the documentary is set up, and it's fascinating on so many levels. They have Bull Connor in it and Diane Nash. I even think they make an allusion to Dr. Fagan's book, Two-Faced Racism, because they have a segment where it's a black guy. He's talking about all these names that they're calling them when they get to the bus stop. He says, they're calling us, you know, coon and nigger and blah, blah, blah. And he says, freelance honey badger. But before he gets to that one, he says, moon crickets. The only place I've ever seen moon crickets is in Two-Faced Racism, where they're talking about some of the racist jokes that white people exchange and how they have code. I think it's in his chapter where he talks about how elaborate white people get with regards to codes, and they can even make up codes on the fly to talk about black people. And one of those codes is moon crickets. I've never seen it anyplace else except that book. But he gives this little spiel. He says, they're calling us nigger coon, moon cricket.
And moon cricket.
Freelance honey badges. He said, I think they're just making stuff up a while to call us. But the episode is fascinating for so many reasons. And then, like I said, it got compounded when I watched it with a young person who didn't really know about the Freedom Ride. And the question the person raised was, this is making fun of really terrorism. I mean, what they did, setting those buses on fire and all that. I mean, this is such a pivotal moment. It's making fun of that. And they were raising that as a legitimate concern, which I really got to see highlighted when I watched this with a 10-year-old and trying to explain to them, this really happened. Like, yes, this is funny, but they are making fun of something that really happened where people could have died. If you've seen that episode, is there any way you can kind of give your thoughts on it?
I actually did not watch much of the fourth season. I ended up tailing off of the Boondocks really after season two. And that was largely I grew increasingly uncomfortable with what I felt the direction of the series was becoming. I felt like during the first two seasons, it was much more guided by a level of social commentary. And that's what made it a very interesting show to watch. But as the show progressed a bit more, I felt that it began to lose much of that because it had become such a mainstream show. So I actually did not see that episode. But I mean, just based off what you said, I can completely see where, again, watching with a young person who is very much removed from some of those events made season very different. And I know that's one thing that continues to surprise me the more that I teach is, for example, today I was teaching about the James Byrd being murdered in Jasper, Texas.
Mm.
My students have no idea what that even is, which blows my mind because it's a very important part of our history. But they have no recollection of it whatsoever because they were just young and it's not something that's heavily discussed. So I think we're going to be in a very interesting situation in the next few years where unless we keep discussing some of these very pivotal events in history, they're going to fade away. They're going to fade away into just textbooks because students today and people in general don't talk about these types of issues, and many weren't alive when they were going on. So for them, it's not real. For them, it's TV. So I think that's something we have to be very vigilant about, is keeping these stories alive so we know the history.
Mm. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. That was part of my thinking, that some folks might see that and then say, oh, maybe I need to go and learn about this, that they would maybe catch that Bull Connor is a real person, Julian Bond, Diane Nash, these are – some of these folks are real people that maybe we need to go and check on it. I'll have to give anybody that's seen that down the road, we might have to devote maybe 5 minutes to discussing that, because I did think that was really significant. And I totally agree with your analysis of the progression of the series. I really think there was a huge drop-off in terms of just how explicit this show was about racism. I was just telling someone last week, if we're just looking at like the first two seasons and then maybe specific points, much fewer, but maybe a few episodes here and there, it's one of the most direct programs with regards to talking about racism. I can't think of much I would compare it to over the last decade. I think it's at the top, like hands down. I can't even think of anything that's done a better job at just being direct about racism, white supremacy, and how it manifests in different ways, just in a variety of ways. And even through the lens of a child, I think that makes it stand out even more for the times when they were on a mission, it seemed. Did I interrupt you?
No, you did not.
Oh, okay. Also wanted to make sure I asked as well, just kind of going back to your dissertation, the piece where you talk about how it's fundamental, the foundation of having a discussion around gun rights and white masculinity and violence and all of that, that white supremacy racism is central to that. And you talk about how that is consistently not a part of how this is normally studied in the academy. I'm even saying, this deflects attention away from the importance of white supremacy in modern gun culture, much of the current scholarship. Do you think that that in and of itself is an act of racism on the part of the white people who are studying this to ignore or minimize the centrality of white supremacy when studying this?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing to do is make it invisible. Is that that's part of, I hate to use the language privilege, but that's part of the privilege of being the dominant group, is that what you do is invisible, and that it doesn't require any type of conversation. Because even whenever we look at gun rights or mass shooting incidents, we don't even have males as the groups writing about the gender dynamics of it. It's white women. And one of the leading scholars of this, Jennifer Carlson up at the University of Toronto. She does incredible work on mass shooting and gun rights groups, but she very much so emphasizes the gender dynamic. Makes the nod to the racial part, says that it is important. And perhaps it's just out the scope of what her project was at that time, but that failure to say, look, yes, it is incredibly important to note the way masculinity is shaping these incidents. It's equally as important to note the way in which white supremacy is shaping these events too. We can't try to simply explain it by saying, oh, it's just a matter of hegemonic masculinity influencing people. That's way too simplistic, because that does not explain why the majority of perpetrators are white. So that's a conversation that has to be engaged in if we really want to understand what's going on with these mass shooters.
My suspicion is, just because I see this happen on a regular basis, again, I would parallel it to when white people talk about racism, white supremacy, they will glorify Dr. Peggy McIntosh and the NAFSAT, because it just makes it a very passive way of talking about racism and white people's performance practice of white supremacy. I would parallel it to that. I think white people are very good, and in my view, it's deliberate at not calling attention to their racism, white supremacy, because that helps to keep it in place. I feel like they would prefer to have inaccurate scholarship on this gun rights culture, because it doesn't expose them, it does not expose white pathology, which I think it's the same pattern for the way that racism is taught in the academy, and pretty much anything, even some of the discussions where I've been in literature, I mean, that's the central theme, so it pops up in all of the disciplines, even folks, when you get into English, I can give a nod to Chinua Achebe, where you do an analysis of literature, okay, we're going to discuss
Joseph Conrad, we can't really be as accurate as possible about this because that means we would have to indict this as racism, white supremacy, and maybe even the entire academy, which has lionized this work and aggressively attacked people who said, hey, this is racist. We're glorifying white supremacy and attacked someone like Chinua Achebe, who calls that work out accurately as racism, white supremacy, where even once he dies and people have all these great things to say about him, they still got to make sure they get in their jabs that he was misguided and way off base in trying to attack the legend Joseph Conrad scholarship. I just feel like that is a consistent, and in my view, it's a deliberate act of racism, white supremacy for them to obscure and leave this out, even at the expense of accurate scholarship.
Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, in one area that we see that practice very much realizes in the realm of critical race theory is that if you get into looking at critical race theory, white folks who teach or study critical race theory fundamentally have to misread critical race theory and have to misrepresent critical race theory if they are to justify their own existence in that field of study. Because if we read Bell, right, Derek Bell, the founders, he doesn't make an allowance for white people. He does not say that white people have a space in this discipline. Yet, the white folks who will read Bell and want to talk about Bell will want to say, well, that was just a thought project Bell was having. Bell wasn't really serious about that. He didn't really mean that. You just simply haven't read Bell. So I think we have that. That's a general trend across the academy, is that you have white scholars who will want to study or claim to study black authors, but they have to misread black authors and misrepresent their work so that they can make an allowance for themselves in doing what they do.
Ashe, could not agree more. Very much enjoyed having our guest, Dr. Couch, on the program. Make sure I get my appreciation and gratitude in for Dr. Curry as well for the suggestion during his last visit. We will definitely be on the lookout for the dissertation when it becomes public, the title again, so folks can jot it down, be looking out as well. Prepared, Not Paranoid, An Examination of Race and Gender Within Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. When can folks kind of expect that this is going to be published?
It should be coming out around the summertime.
2015 summertime?
2015 summertime, yes.
Okay. Outstanding.
That's the goal. Summer 2015.
Outstanding. Will give us something to look forward to about this time next year. Really, really appreciate you sharing a bit of your Thursday evening with us. We will definitely look forward to having you back on the program to continue the discussion. I know there's so many of these shooting incidents. It would be great to kind of pick your brain about how these events get talked about and reported. Maybe you'll have a chance to see that episode of The Boondocks by then as well. So we can
I'll make that a point.
Outstanding. Thank you so much, Dr. Couch. It has been a pleasure, and we will definitely be in touch with you soon. Please keep up your outstanding and much-needed scholarship, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for having me.
Outstanding. Enjoy your evening. We will speak soon.
All right. Thank you. You too, sir.
Yes, sir. Bye. Goodbye. Context of White Supremacy, Dr. Todd C. Couch, Texas A&M University. Man, outstanding, outstanding. I will be looking forward to reading the full. I got to read a few excerpts, but I will be looking forward to reading the full presentation next summer when it's available. I will let folks know so you can track it down and read it yourself if you are so inclined. I will take a quick break and then see if folks have any comments they want to share, anything that they want to get in. Briefly, I was reminded of Ariella Gross, What Blood Won't Tell. She was a guest on the program in 2009, and she talks about, basically is talking about racial classifications and how they can fluctuate. Racism is not, it's basically whatever we say, whatever white people say, who gets accepted as white and who's going to be designated as not white. But she talks about one of the central aspects of being a white person was you were expected to be armed and ready to kill non-white people. This is like explicit in 18th century, 19th century United States. This is what it means to be a black person, excuse me, a white person. You are supposed to be armed and ready to slaughter non-white people. And that has just endured, in my opinion. That's why if you look on my Facebook page, they have a photograph of a white officer in Ferguson. There has been an uptick in the quote-unquote unrest in Ferguson this week. The memorial, one of the memorials to Michael Brown, was kind of a spot outside where they had flowers and candles, et cetera, and it was burned. And people suspect that this was done deliberately. There was even a report where a witness alleged that an enforcement officer was on the scene and did not make an effort to try to put this fire out, and that the officer might have even started this fire. But it was reported that they think this contributed to the upsurge in unrest in Ferguson, where some stores were vandalized again, and the protest was, I guess, a bit more heated. But they had photographs of a white officer wearing a wristband that said, "I am Darren Wilson." And as if they had photographs, and they had other articles that were responding to this, verifying that this was true. And even Captain Ron Johnson, the black male who's been, quote unquote, in charge, he was asked about this at a press conference. Did he know that this was happening? And apparently it was several officers who had these wristbands, and he said he was going to speak with them. But again, to me, that just shows that bonding, white coalescence around practicing racism, especially killing black people. And the same with Daniel Holtzclaw, the white officer in Ohio, who has been charged, arrested for raping at least 8 black females and is now bonded out on house arrest. Do you think that would happen if it was a white officer been accused of raping exclusively 8 white women? I don't think so. But yeah, the same thing, where he can get money raised and is out chilling at home watching television. Same thing. White people, they unite around practicing racism. I think the evidence is overwhelming, and this is not ignorance. This is dedication, devotion to racism, white supremacy. As I said, we'll take a quick commercial break. Folks have any thoughts they want to get in before we conclude, we will make time for that as well. Context of white supremacy, we should be right back. Hang tight.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design that's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at trimultimedia.com.
Everyone, welcome. This is Justice with the Cows Radio program. If you want to learn about, understand, and counter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed, packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words, to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, to be able to invest in my counter racist efforts, co-hosting the Cows Radio program, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
I got an uncle real crazy. My Uncle B, 55 years old, hates white people, married to a white lady. And he's sitting around going, you know, these crackers ain't shit, except for Susan. He tried to explain the whole thing to me one day, say, yeah, I got a white wife, I love her, she love me, that's all that matter. But I tell you this, if the revolution ever come, I'll kill her first. Just to show these crackers I mean business. Motherfucker cracker ass, motherfucker cracker, shit cracker motherfucker. Well, hey, hi honey. Motherfucker cracker, I'll kill my cracker kid too.
Context of white supremacy. We should be back tomorrow. Third installment, Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It. Man, incredible book. Listeners voted on this one. This was not me. I don't think I would have chosen this for the book club, even though I would have read it on my own. But man, outstanding choice. Very much excited about tomorrow. And woo-wee. If you have been following along, just gets better as we roll. Can't wait. Tomorrow, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The legend. Richard Williams. Saturday, compensatory call-in. Sunday, Dr. Missy Harris, black female. She's pretty gorgeous, too. And then Monday, black male joining us live from Sweden. We'll probably be very early Monday morning, but always a hoot to hear from black folks in different parts of the world. I was able to see Blackish. It is repugnant. Dr. Welsing asked me about it. I talked to her on Monday. And I said, no, I haven't seen it. It just came out. It came out subsequently since I spoke with her. But I watched it. It was horrible, as I expected it to be. it was horrendous. You do not need to waste time. Actually, I think I am going to watch it just to study and take note. But it is total terrorism. I would compare it to Precious. It's just terrorism directly aimed at black people. Speaking of which, Scandal, the fourth season begins tonight, and the episode is titled Randy, Red, Super Freak, and Julia. Now, I don't know what all that is about because I don't watch Scandal, and I do not intend on watching this episode, but that's the name of the title. I'm even reminded, Randy, you can have the name Randy, but I think that also has some sexual connotation to it. I'm going to read from the dictionary just to make it, yep, that's what I thought. Randy, informal, sexually aroused or excited. Randy, R-A-N-D-Y, which is
what they have this episode titled. Again, it's Randy, Red, Super Freak, and Julia. That's how they portray a pregnant black female, which is Kerry Washington right now. Terrorism piped into your home every week. I think that did come up before, that it was suggested that Kerry Washington is the smartest person on the show. I vehemently disagree. I would say anybody, if that's the conclusion that you've come to from watching Scandal, I have no idea what show you are watching or your perception of racism, white supremacy, but there is no way she is the smartest person on the show. I would say maybe most degraded, maybe most mistreated, but definitely not the smartest person on the show from what I've seen. People are talking to her like a dog all the time. I just don't see that at all. At any rate, I was checking the case with Hannah Strong. I don't know if folks followed that white female at Syracuse University. She called a black male profanity coming. Again, I do not censor when it is racist white people talking. So she called a black person on video a faggot-ass nigger. And in my view, there should be a cowbell there because she looks like a white female. She was with black people. To me, it very much looked as though she might have been having sexual intercourse with at least one of the black males that was present. She just was way too comfortable. And it did not look like she was amongst strangers. These looked like people they were hanging out for a Saturday evening, her fellow students probably sexually sewering at least one, if not more, of these black males. But that, to me, just again highlighted how white people like Crystal Tyler, that they can be around, be having sex with black people and have total contempt for black people. That is the high, which should not be surprising or strange. Strom Thurmond, Thomas Jefferson, there's a long, undeniable history of this sort of behavior on the part of white males and white females. But that's another illustration of your young white people who are not supposed to be racist. At any rate, the last thing I wanted to get in, and then, like I said, if folks have comments, anything they want to share, I'll make time so that you all can comment. I guess, need to give a kudos, appreciation to the folks in the Cows Facebook group, not the page, right? There's the Cows page, but the actual Cows group where other people can post links on the main page and comment and all that, where you can request to be a member, that one. I had said repeatedly I didn't make any of the Cows Facebook pages. I really am not all that into Facebook. They just use it to track black people and snoop on us. But folks, you know, have made an effort, some people, to use it in a constructive manner, to share information, to network with other people, so forth. But I had noted that, you know, at least about 2 years ago, that it had got a lot less constructive. It was a lot of name calling and just a lot of behaviors that I do not encourage, endorse. Frankly, a lot of stuff I just am not interested in seeing if it's just going to be Coon this and Uncle Tom that and Sambo this. I have no interest in that and would prefer not to see it on any of my pages. That being said, a couple weeks back, I was speaking with a black male on Facebook. Man, I posted a link about Hannah Strong. You can go back and see. I posted when I first heard about this incident that she had done this. So I posted a link about this. And the comments that I got were not about, you know, no, she didn't do that. No. The comments were about, because I called her a heifer when I wrote the post. You can go back and see that. And the person said, I thought you're not in the name calling. And I said, that's true. I broke my code, and I did so to call her a heifer. So I acknowledged that. And I said, also, I'm doing some subtle advertising, right? Heifer, cows. And so he said, I thought we're not supposed to be about name calling. See, that's why your group is not evolving. In fact, I took screenshots of these because I thought it would be important to share on the program the nature of what transpired. So I will read the exact transcript from the conversation. So I posted on Hannah Strong, bang, the commentary. I thought you weren't into name calling. And I said, I'm not, but if I'm going to let one slip, I'm real cool with it being directed at this racist. Plus, heifers are cows. I'm plugging the program. He responds, a heifer is a heifer. A spade is a spade. Your whole group is held back because they don't command the English language. My response, who exactly is my whole group and whom is holding us back? And is failure to command English language grounds for mistreatment? All questions. He says, the cows, man, the group page, they act like we can't call niggas niggas. I'm not talking about no mistreatment. I'm black, so I don't need the racism white supremacy questionnaire. When I say command, your heifers and bulls act like some words are off limits. I respond, that's why I rarely get into name calling. I have no idea what problem will be solved by calling other victims niggas. We've been doing that for many, many, many years. I've not seen where that has made us better women and men or helped us deal with whites. Feel free to make your own group where you can name call any and all non-white people. His response, I'm not insinuating we play the dozens. Just some things are what they are, and your people don't know how to call them out, though it seems you want to make exceptions for yourself when it directed solely at whites. I responded, well, as I said, it would be best to not name call at all, even whites. That's generally what I stick to. I broke my code this morning, and this is what I get. Learned my lesson. I don't have a group of people. Folks are free to do what they think is best. As are you. Again, feel free to make your own group where you call out anyone you like. I have nothing more to say on this matter. Cheers. He got in final response. He said, thanks. I'm glad you quickly found the solution to this problem. And that was the end of the exchange, which, again, did illustrate for me, it would be best not to name call at all. This is war. We should be serious about that at all times. Leave all of the tackiness and name-calling to whites, and I've not seen where name-calling solves any problems, which is what I said to him. But the gratitude would go out for the folks in the group if this was happening where someone wanted to go in and call other non-white people niggers or any other names, and people on the group alerted that person that that is not acceptable on the page and that we shouldn't be doing that. That is outstanding. That, in my view, is exactly what we should be doing. Again, I have not seen, pick any non-white person you like, I have never seen where us sitting around and criticizing and name-calling other non-white people, I have not seen where that solves one problem for us. I've never seen where that improves our life in any way, shape, or form. I've never seen where that has done anything to get a black person housing, a business license, a visa, nothing, a job, nothing. I've never seen that. And I've seen a lot of us name-calling other black people down through the years. I've never seen where it moved us forward in solving this problem one iota. And just on the basis of black self-respect, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time getting upset at other black people because they don't want to identify another black person as a nigger. I've seen a lot of that in my life. I've never seen where it's been helpful. Black self-respect. Black self-respect. Anywho, the folks, if you have anything you would like to share, thought it was great information from Dr. Couch, feel free. If anyone has seen that episode of the Boondocks, the Freedom Ride or Die, that would be interesting. I might be interested in hearing feedback on that because I thought that was probably one of the most important episodes of season four. Not that that should overshadow the serious nature of this evening's dialogue or commentary on Eric Holder's resignation. That's obviously way more important than the Boondocks. Folks, the folks that dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I guess I should give the person is there anybody on the line who hadn't been able to ask a question, had something that they wanted to add or comment on?
Hello, Gus. I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
Or make a comment. Once again, thank you for the show for today. You did a great segue to what I was just getting ready to say, racism, white supremacy. This is another sad day for me today with the announcement of Eric Holder to resign as Attorney General. Boy, when I got home from work today, I saw that and I thought, wow, I would like to know what Dr. Francis Chris Wilson has to say and what Gus' thoughts are on the matter. But for me, it certainly is a sad day.
I said briefly when I saw it, and I think I saw it very early this morning because nobody had shared any links on it and what have you. I think it was about 6-7 o'clock my time. It was pretty early over here. Even on the East Coast, that would be mildly early. But there just wasn't a whole lot. The Times at the time, New York Times, they had a very short article on it. It just didn't seem like there was much commentary at first. But my initial thoughts were surprise, and then I said, well, wait a minute. He was going to step down in 2012. He was going to leave. He was going to transition at the conclusion of President Obama's first term, but then he stayed on. So he had been talking about leaving publicly for years. So that kind of made me step back and say, oh, okay, well, you know, this shouldn't be that much of a surprise. But it made me think wow, the amount of pressure that he has. I mean, he's been held in first attorney general ever to be held in contempt of Congress around Fast and Furious, as I mentioned earlier. I know there are a lot of non-white people who are not pleased with his performance, and they think he should have done behaved differently. There are things that they would have liked to have seen him do that he did not. But that being said, I know he has said a lot about racism. He stuck to his guns on that comment about being a nation of cowards for not honestly addressing racism. He was in Ferguson and talked about racism pretty bluntly then as well. He came out earlier this year, even as Ms. Tyler pointed out, in publicly criticizing the educational system for saying that the racial discrimination was abhorrible with regards to the punishment that was leveled at black students, particularly, and non-white students on the whole. His efforts, he has even honestly addressed the same racism, white supremacy with regards to punitive actions for nonviolent drug offenses. And the same thing, I've heard people criticize him for not doing more, but he has stepped up and spoken about that publicly and has even worked to get some of those different types of laws. He has gotten some of them changed, even though, as I said, I know a lot of people wish that he had done a lot more, but just even that right there. And he's addressed Seattle. He is named as a defendant right here in Seattle because the Department of Justice mandated that they make changes because there were so many allegations of racism and unlawful use of force on the behalf of enforcement officials. He's named as a defendant. There are about 100 white officers who said that what they've done is incorrect and unlawful and has made it impossible for them to do their jobs as peace officers and to protect their own lives. So I can only imagine, or really probably, that's not even true, I probably can't even begin to imagine the type of pressure that he's been under since 2009, the things that he has heard privately, and maybe even an inclination of what President Obama has to look forward to in the last 2 years before he exits the White House. It just, as a non-white person, I suspect he has, you talk about plantation and terrorism, I'm sure he has been up to his eyeballs in it for about the last 6 years, and it just looks like he is totally done and ready to roll. But I, too, would be very interested in hearing what Dr. Welsing has to say about his departure.
Yeah, and when I saw that today, I thought, wow, this is once again one of those situations where white people do not want to look themselves in the mirror and be accountable for their mistreatment and disrespect against black people. And I certainly think that some of that, although we won't be privy to what goes on in that arena, but I suspect that some of that mistreatment and disrespect that he was getting, as well as the president, maybe wore him down.
Oh, I agree. I think Dr. Welsing had said that she was talking about President Obama, but just saying that, matter of fact, she and Dr. Niana Rasayan, both, they were talking about President Obama, but just saying that they felt he looked just worn down, really fatigued, just having white people trying to see him fail at all times, and everything that he's been up against. I suspect that has probably been the same for Eric Holder. I think the Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks, he mentioned, I think, Attorney General Eric Holder by name and saying that he was waging war against white people. So I suspect that probably greatly contributed to him stepping down today.
And, yeah, I certainly agree with you. I just, with every day, I grow stronger in my thought that white people have no intentions on helping black people develop to their full potential in any people activity. And with every event that happens to us, I'm certainly reinforced with my thoughts on that matter.
Absolutely. It's pretty obvious in my opinion. Again, you can watch Scandal tonight, Randy, Red, Super Freak, and Julia, if you have any confusion about that. Any of the other folks that are on the line, did you all have anything you wanted to share?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey, yeah. Yeah, I too am sorry to see Attorney General Holder go, particularly with one of the last reports on the compensatory call-in show where it talks about how the Justice Department under him has increased their civil rights enforcement on police departments, you know, while more could use federal monitoring, at least it's pointed out the effort was being increased. So I will give him a plus on that. And also you have to remember, people have been after this man ever since he was announced for the position. I mean, there white people still blame him for a quote-unquote presidential pardon of Mark Rich. He was a white embezzler that skipped the country, and Bill Clinton ended up pardoning him. Now, I don't know how he gets blamed for a presidential pardon. That's beyond me. But this is what we're dealing with. And anyway, I mean, if you remember the confirmation hearings, I mean, they were equally hostile. Tim Geithner, admitted tax cheat, was nominated for Treasury Secretary. He didn't face that much heat as Attorney General Holder did. And I also wanted, I forgot to ask Professor Couch if, being that he was out of Texas A&M and we're talking about these mass shootings, active shootings, was he going to begin his work on Charles Whitman? Because many people consider that was where modern active shooting started, you know, right there with Texas A&M, the famous Deadly Tower incident. And also, he also talked about how these white people are doing these things because of imaginary situations, how they're going to go after all these people. I don't know if you tend to notice, when it comes to these active shootings, there are a lot of times there are people there besides the active shooter that have firearms, like Luby, Texas. All of them had their guns in their cars when George Hennett came there and started shooting up the restaurant and all the people in it. With all those people with those guns, not a single one of them engaged Hennard. The same with Jared Loughner and a bunch of others. That's because a lot of people really talk a good game, but when they come down to it, they only really want to go after the weak, unarmed, like a Trayvon Martin,
or Mike Brown. But equal force, a lot of these people are cowards. That's all I got to say.
You mentioned the Texas shooting. I'm make sure we didn't miss anybody. If anyone who hasn't cheered yet, if they had something they wanted to get in, but Charles Whitman's rifle went up for sale today, and the bids started at $25,000. That, in my opinion, once again, evidence of white pathology and the really worshiping of killing that is mandatory under the system of white supremacy. But that was just reported 9 hours ago today that his rifle went up for sale, bidding started at $25,000. Is anybody on the line who hadn't shared yet had something they wanted to get in briefly before we conclude?
Can I make another comment?
I'm assuming everybody else is good. Everybody else is good.
Gus, can I make another comment?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I am just mind-boggled with how we have not moved forward in the area of entertainment, and we are still shuffling and buffooning in the area of entertainment. I refuse to watch Scandal, and when I saw the billboard signs for, I guess it's the Blackish, I was extremely disappointed that Larry Fishburne, I think that's his name, is executive producer for that show, because I thought he was more conscious of his activities. But apparently I was wrong. And even the name resonated with me as something that would be buffoonish, without even giving it any thought to watching it. And I am still, for the life of me, mind-boggled that we are still shuffling and buffooning in the area of entertainment.
I am befuddled by many things, but that does not surprise me. I think, number one, you have most, if not all, non-white people being confused about racism, white supremacy, and just being in a weak and vulnerable position. It's very easy to get non-white people to behave in a silly, not serious manner. I think that's one of the main products of a system of white supremacy, really of terrorism, is we, all of us really, are trained, expected to behave in a manner that will be pleasing to white people. They have more power, and it's easy for them to set up that dynamic and train us to think in that manner. I think that's how a lot of us behave, and we're not even on a television show in terms of not being serious. I think Dr. Kanban says that all the time, as does Mr. Fuller. We're very serious about not being very serious. And again, can't emphasize enough, that's kind of what you can expect when you have a dominant power system, dominant power structure, where one group of people is in a very weak position, where you just have a lot of people who end up being very silly. If that's what will keep them alive, keep them safe, keep them out of the ire of racist psychopaths. That being said, I think with entertainment, I mean, you're talking about that is highly valued under a system of white supremacy. That's something that white people will give you a lot of money. I mean, that's a lot more cornbread than you would get working at McDonald's or, you know, some other little chump job, and plus you get to be on television. You know, you're a star, and people think so much of you. That right there has value in and of itself. So it's very easy. I'm sure there are a lot of black people who would do that for free. You wouldn't even have to pay them, just, you know, being able to be on television and being seen. So I definitely understand the psychology of how that works. Not just for black people, for non-white people in total, because they have a show Fresh Off the Boat that features a so-called Asian family that's the same thing. And thinks on the same network even as Black-ish and Scandal. They're all three on the same network, but that is coming on this fall, and it's pretty much the same thing, making non-white people buffoons and clowns and worshiping white people. That's what that show is all about. Even the name just makes it very obvious, Fresh Off the Boat. That's one thing I would say I'm not really surprised about. It's easy when you have people in a totally weak, confused state, to just say, well, we'll give you a lot of money and we can put you on television, if you're going to be silly, and act goofy. It's very easy, under these conditions to get people that, will do that. That's what racism, white supremacy produces. That's what racism, white supremacy looks like. So, yeah, I don't have that's something that doesn't shock me at all. It just demonstrates that we're still under the system of racism, white supremacy.
Unbelievable. Thank you again for a wonderful show.
Definitely wouldn't encourage watching Black-ish. As I said, I'm just doing it for study purposes, but it's even more interesting because the main character, the black male, Anthony Anderson, he works for a television network. So it's kind of wild. Like that's kind of his job on the show as well, being a buffoon and clown for white people, which they're kind of making fun of. But it's wild on many levels. Not that, again, would not encourage watching it. It's ridiculous, as I expected it would be. It's not worth your time and energy. It's got to be better things you can do with your time. At any rate, we should be back. If folks catch any information that is relevant, Attorney General Eric Holder or anything else pops up, feel free to share. We'll be looking forward to discussing this on the Saturday program. Again, we'll be back tomorrow. Mr. Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It, number 3. We should be here on Saturday with a compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. On Sunday, Dr. Missy Harris, she'll be here normal program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And then on Monday, very early morning Monday, Black Male joining us live from Sweden, Mr. Subin. Will be great to hear his views. He seems to be less confused about what is happening on this planet in Sweden specifically. You can even go back in the archives when we had Jalo Momodou on the program, also a black male in Sweden. He's a lot less confused. He was giving us the report when they had the slave party at Lund University, where whites were mimicking a slave auction. If you go back, he was a guest on the program a couple times. Should be always a hoot to hear from black folks in different parts of the planet. That being said, I hope it was constructive info this evening. Again, the archives should be working. If you have trouble accessing any of the programs from this week, just let me know, but it should be iTunes and all of the other sites should be up and rolling. So feel free, let me know if you have difficulties. Thanks again for those who tuned in. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy this Thursday evening. Invest if you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Skype is at the top right corner of the page. If you're not into Skype, let us know. We can get your mailing address where you can support the program. Thanks again. We will speak in about 24 hours. Creator, help us remain patient with other victims of racism, other black people. Help us remain patient with ourselves. Help us understand and never underestimate our eternal enemies, racist woman, racist man, racist child. Help us remain codified at all times and demonstrate black self-respect in all areas of people activity every time we are in contact with another black person. Allow us to keep our ancestors in the forefront and draw on them for strength, resilience, dedication to our assignment, replacing
white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Thanks all for tuning in. Context of White Supremacy signing out. We will be back soon.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.